Hello.
I like that picture.
I thought I would try to do like yours.
That's sweet.
So we can be rival mockingbirds.
That's right.
I didn't even remember what my picture was, and so I looked at it, and then I was, you press the button to change picture, and it automatically brought that up, and I thought, oh, that looks like Mike's.
That's nice. Very,
Mysterious.
very impressive.
Thank you. So this is Geek Brunch Retrocast, episode 42. I
That's right.
don't think that we've said the name of the podcast in quite a while. I think it's been a few episodes at least.
I know we say the episode, but I don't know about the name.
I know by the end of the episode we're usually trying to figure out what number it is, but I think it's been a while since we started out the show.
Yeah, I'm Mike, and with me is who are you?
Katmatui.
Katmatui.
Kakatuti.
Somebody's reading some Green Lantern.
Yeah. I'm Chris Tui.
Chris Tui.
Chris Tui from Korrigar.
Newlywed.
Yes, I'm still married.
Yes.
3 weeks, I think it's been.
Yeah.
A little
Three
over 3 weeks.
glorious weeks.
Yes, it's been good.
Yeah.
It has been good. Yeah, so I saw that you had some retro television purchases.
Yeah,
You bought some
I went
more
on
retro TV.
a tangent of I had went to let's see, Target, and I saw they had the $6 Million Man, so I bought season one and two, and I said, oh, that's cool, I'll get the others when they come out. And then I saw on Amazon that they were already out. It's just that Target didn't have them, so I ordered the all the way through the fifth season. And while I was in there, Amazon does a very good job of looking at my profile and saying, man, I think you would like this. So I was like, well, shit, I was talking to Shannon Gallant, who's the artist of G.I. Joe, A Real American Hero, at Baltimore Con. And he loves retro stuff. Like, his icon is the Bigfoot from $6 Million Man. And we were talking about Buck Rogers because we talk about it a lot on the show. And, it's Aaron Gray, he like loves Aaron Gray, like I love Aaron Gray and stuff like that. And we started talking about Gil Gerard's stunt doubles. And he brought up Wonder Woman, and he's like, well, you think Gil Gerard's stunt doubles are bad? You need to go rewatch the Wonder Woman ones. And I'm like, oh, wow. I said, well, what's so unique about that? And he says, because they're men. And I'm like, okay, that'll be interesting. So I added the complete Wonder Woman series. And if you guys know me on Facebook, I love Wonder Woman. I mean, you at least see a Wonder Woman post every now and then. And I was like, I need to revisit this. So I bought this.
I don't know about every now and then. I think it's a daily thing.
And then all of a sudden I was like, man, I really love Logan's Run, and I have the movie, and I really want to cover it on this show. I like want to so bad. And I was like, you know what? Barb has never seen the series, like the TV show, which I used to watch, and it's only a short season, like 14 episodes. And I was like, man, I really want to get Logan's Run, so I went and got that. So, yeah. There was a lot of retro TV. Oh, and then there was another one. Man from Atlantis. I went and purchased Man from Atlantis as well. So a lot of
Nice.
retro TV.
I have a couple of the I have two out of the three seasons of Wonder Woman on DVD.
Nice.
I think either the three pack or like the complete collection wasn't out when I got it, or I think I might have gotten them used or something for really cheap. So I just went ahead and gotten them or something, but
Well, that's very cool.
yeah.
Yeah, so I went ahead and did that. It was like a little splurge.
They got you. Amazon got you.
They got me.
Their recommendations.
Yep, they sucked me in. They're
Yeah.
starting to learn me. They got their neural nets working and they're starting to learn me. They're like, this guy likes
Yeah.
to spend money.
They're
Let's
completing their profile.
Yeah, this guy
Finding its
likes a lot of
profile.
old TV.
Nice. Yeah, it's amazing today how easy it is to find and rewatch the old shows, you know, compared to how it used to be.
Yeah, it's kind of I find it refreshing. Like it's good to mix the stuff. Like right now I'm watching Arrow. I'm trying to get caught up because I love the show. I'm trying to get Barb sucked into it too. I'm trying.
Yeah, I saw that you decided to go with the DVDs or the Blu-rays on those.
Yeah, I couldn't wait, and I wanted to
Yeah.
start DVRing the thing, and my DVR is gonna get exhausted because I don't have like an up-to-date DVR. I really need to get one, but I could run out of space with all these damn new comic shows that I want to watch.
I
And then
know.
there's The Strain, and I absolutely love The Strain. Under the Dome finish, so that at least frees up a spot, but. You know, there's Gotham and there's Flash and there's Arrow and Constantine and iZombie and it's like hell. So I have to get caught up. I can't let Arrow just start stacking up. So I can let
Yeah.
2 or 3 or 4 weeks even stack up, but I gotta catch up. So if I keep watching Arrow, I will be caught up soon. And it just takes one like elliptical exercise, and I've gone through an episode. So it's like bang, you
Yeah,
know, bang, just knock it out every night. Knock one out.
it's a good way to do it.
Yeah.
Yeah, we'll see. I'm gonna try to when Arrow gets added to Netflix season 2, I'm gonna in there. But
It's soon. I think they just.
yeah.
They postponed it from September to October, which is just around the corner. It's already this coming week.
Yeah. And so I'm gonna try to watch all of season 2 before I think Hulu usually has 5 episodes. So I got basically a little over a month to try to watch season 2 before the new episodes on Hulu disappear. You know, the first episode disappears on Hulu or something.
Yeah.
We'll see, but I don't know if I'll make it or not, but I didn't watch. I pretty much just watched the first season through Netflix like you did, 'cause it didn't catch me at first. Same as you, I kind of watched the first episode or two and didn't really get hooked on it.
Yeah, I thought it was gonna be like another Smallville, and I really didn't like Smallville. I dipped my toe in, kind of like I did Agents of Shield, you know? I tried it. Many times, even when they had like the Justice League appear and stuff, and I was like, I got a little bit addicted in one season, and then it just dropped off. So I was like, but Arrow has been like a slow build. Like, it's almost like reading that comic that isn't a 5 out of 5 initially, it's more like a 3 out of 5. And then you just get sucked into the characterization. I got sucked into the characters, I got sucked into the plot. I love the Easter eggs. The writers of that show, they cater towards fans of the comic book. And they'll throw in Easter eggs, they'll throw in characters, and you're like, oh, that's pretty badass. So I like where that's going. I think Flash is gonna be in the same tone. I like the premiere of Gotham, so I'm pretty happy with the TV. The bad thing is it takes away from comic reading or And the one thing I really hate to do, it's not a bad task, it's just time constraint, is comic book maintenance. And I have to do that today because it's getting out of control. But I'd rather sit there and just read like all kinds of stuff. But there's a time when you have to clean up your messes and sort things and put them in the right boxes and enter them into the database and all that
Right.
to give my wife her kitchen table back.
Not too bad, but I have a tendency to just take a while to refile stuff. So I'll just stack it on top of the boxes instead. So I still have comics that I covered on the show like 3 episodes ago, like on top of the boxes, because I haven't gone in and put them back yet.
I'm not quite that bad, but the one thing I'm really bad, the one thing that I don't do that this part of the task I absolutely hate. And I would love to hire somebody trustworthy to do it. And it's the one thing I hate is the merge. And what I mean by the merge, it's like pulling out the drawer boxes, putting in the new books, merge, 'cause what I do is I get these collections and I put them in different corners. Oh, here's from these years to these years, and here's these years to these years. And then I get lazy and I just start sorting them and then putting them down there. And I never merge them into the collection. Like if it's a Green Arrow title, I won't merge it with the first series or second series. It's the new 52 series. And I want to have them in alphabetical order and in order and easy to find, but that's the part that absolutely hate. And when you get past 20,000 comics, like I'm at about 55,000 comics, it is a chore,
Yeah, I can imagine.
because the merge is not just opening up a drawer box and putting in the comics you bagged and boarded. It's having to open up 30 drawer boxes and then have extra drawer boxes so you can do the merge, because they won't fit. In other words, I never have like all this empty space of filing. The boxes are usually pretty full. So you have to do this whole rearranging of boxes and it
Yeah, just
sucks.
like a big shift. Well, what we'll do is when we're done recording, I'll tell you how much I make, and you can just see if you can match that, and then I'll move out there, and that'll be my job.
Job. Honey, we're gonna go sort comic books.
Yeah. Care to find a job in Colorado? I've already got something arranged.
That'd be sweet.
And
If I was rich, I would do that. I definitely.
yeah, personal. It's like, no, I don't have a maid. I just have a personal comic book sorter.
Yeah. And I used to have a lot of vices, or I used to collect a lot of stuff like toys, and I've backed off on the toys. I've backed up on the statues. I'm not buying statues anymore, and I kind of it's just comics. And
Yeah, I mean, well, it's like you run out of time, when you're an adult, just don't have time for everything.
the damn shame is you're. I want to be like Highlander. I want to live forever, and it's not gonna fucking happen. At some point, logic has to kick in, and it has to say, "Well, really, you ought to start selling this stuff." So my goal is to get to retirement, and start offloading stuff. But we'll see. 'Cause where is it gonna go? I mean, am I gonna burn on a glorious Viking funeral of comic books?
Well, you could.
Light me up, baby.
Yeah. Unless you end up with somebody that wants them, and I guess worst case scenario, they'd be offloaded in like a estate sale or something.
So
But
I have one announcement to make. Let me see before I forget. Elaine Atkins Manley, who's Robert Atkins' sister, is a coordinator of various comic book conventions, and she's going to be running a small one in Vermont, Burlington, Vermont. And it's going to be October 25th and 26th at the Sheraton Hotel. It's a 2-day event. It looks like it's a real small startup initially, because they have top artists like Marvel's Dick Bradshaw, Walking Dead's Will Torres, Image Comics' Nate Belegrade, and IDW's Blair Shedd. So there's not like a lot of big names, but here's where the link to the show comes in, okay? Appearances by actress Bicycle Girl from Walking Dead, but here's where the big one is. TV's Gil Gerard from Buck Rogers in the 25th Century.
Nice.
Nice. So check out the Vermont Comic Con October 25th and 26th at the at Burlington, Vermont at the Sheraton Hotel. So I just wanted to point that out.
Nice. I wonder, I'm trying to think. Burlington's probably, see, I think it's like 6.5 or 7-ish to get into Massachusetts a bit. It's probably quite a hike from here.
That's a huge hike for me. So
Yeah. Well, yeah, if you're gonna.
I won't be going to that one, but
Yeah.
if I was within a like 2 hours, I would go there, and it would be primarily to see Gil Gerard.
Oh, hell yeah.
I'd go there and I'd shake his hand and I'd say, "Damn, let's talk some Buck Rogers," because I want to talk Buck Rogers with Gil Gerard. I want to know what it was like to kiss all those women.
Yeah. Yeah, every episode they found a new actress
Sexy,
for him to
sexy
kiss.
woman, yeah.
Yep. Not a bad gig. Well, since we're talking about him, should we start off with that this time?
Yeah, let's do that.
Our episode this time was called A Dream of Jennifer. And it's the, I think it looks like it's about the 20th episode of the season. There were a couple actresses in this that I thought had some notable info about them. The really the main guest character of the episode. She looks just like Buck's old girlfriend Jennifer, the character. Her real name turns out to be Layla Markison, but she was played by a woman named Anne Lockhart. And turns out that she's pretty well known for another retro sci-fi show. She was Lieutenant Sheba on the original Battlestar
Oh shit. I knew I had known her from somewhere.
Galactica.
No, I like 'cause it's her eyes. Like I like looked at her eyes and I was like, I know that character, but I just didn't place her. And yesterday it was a busy day, so I didn't want to do research on it, but I was like, man, but then I was like, I thought maybe she'd be on like one of those shows I don't give a shit about, like Dallas or one of those
Well, yeah,
soapy
'cause
dramas that I didn't care about. But now you say Battlestar Galactica, I remember her. That's awesome. She was
I
a
thought it was
pilot.
yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So there was that's probably why you recognize her
I
eyes
wonder if
because
she was the one that dated Apollo or Starbuck. I can't remember.
That I can't help you with. I
Yeah, I
don't really
can't.
know the
I
original.
think she did, but maybe I'm thinking of some other character. That's another show I need to start watching.
And the only other one I wanted to mention, because like you said, a lot of these episodes, when you take a look at the actors and actresses, you see that they're, were your television actors that bounced around and had guest appearances on all kinds of different 70s and 80s TV shows. But another woman that was in that episode, her character was named Lola. She's the one of the people that are the villains, a race that are the villains in the episode called the Coven.
With the red faces,
Yeah,
yeah.
they have red faces. She's the woman, she's the prominent woman of that group. She was played by an actress named Mary Warrenov, and she seems pretty cool. She is kind of a cult movie actress. She was originally involved with Andy Warhol and his factory when he was making a lot of films and stuff.
Yeah.
And then she was in a lot of Corman movies and stuff like Death Race 2000, Rock and Roll High School, Night of the Comet, Chopping Mall,
That's
lots of
pretty
stuff like that.
awesome too, because I saw a lot of Corman films. A matter of fact, her face looked familiar too, but it was really hard because it was all just face and it was totally red. So
Right, and
you couldn't see a lot of, all you could see is bone structure and facial structure. You couldn't see the actress.
yeah, I mean, I know I've seen those movies, but I'd have to go back and I didn't recognize her at the time, so I'd have to go back and but she was in a lot of TV shows too. One other thing I noted was that she was in the she was into like the LA punk scene and stuff, and she was in the Suicidal Tendencies video for Institutionalized.
Oh, not nice.
Yeah, so I thought that was cool. But
There
yeah,
was
she's
one other character that looked familiar, but I don't even see him in the credits here. It was the guy that was the magician, the that went to talk to Buck in New Orleans. He looks so damn familiar, but I don't even
Yeah.
see his character in the credits here.
Yeah, I guess you probably have to the look back at the actual credits on the
On the
at the end of
DVD,
the episode or something to catch his name, but because he'll just be buried in IMDb somewhere. But yeah, so
I thought it started off like a really, like I wasn't gonna like the episode, but turned out pretty well, I thought.
yeah,
Like
I
I thought it
agree.
was gonna be like a pouty episode. Like I don't dig those episodes where Buck starts to pout. I am whiny because I'm in the future and it's nothing like the past. And in this case, he saw like the love of his life. And we did get like a, is this our first true flashback?
I'm pretty sure.
Like our first flashback when he was back on Earth before he went to the future.
I think so, yeah.
Yeah, so that was kind of interesting because it actually showed how much he loved this girl Jennifer. And it was like his soulmate, and when he saw somebody that looked like her, he was like, "I gotta track this woman down." And the other interesting thing I thought was heartfelt, which is kind of weird to say for Buck Rogers, but it's when Ewer starts talking about the death of his wife.
Yeah.
That was kind of deep, man. I was like, "Where did this show go?" He's like, Because even though it's a weird show, he seemed really sincere when he was acting it out, you know? It's
Yeah,
like,
definitely. He could he gets he starts thinking about it 'cause of Buck's situation and identifies with her with him.
yeah.
But yeah, I kind of had a similar experience at the beginning, more so because it's one of the interesting things about watching retro sci-fi is to see how they chose to imagine the future and how they'll predict certain things that are really futuristic, but then other things like in this case they the place that Buck initially sees this woman that looks like his girlfriend that he left in the 20th century is a shopping mall in old Chicago.
Yes, that was also very weird.
Yeah, so they, I mean, I think it was the place itself was set up to sort of look a little retro for the people, but I like that they were there to do shopping, that they didn't predict that malls would be pretty much dead, and that the whole idea of the internet and shopping on the internet and stuff like that was that was one of the things they didn't predict, it turns out.
Yeah, and
But
I guess Buck's casual wear consists of like a Luke Cage shirt, except it's purple.
yeah, he's got that crazy V-neck going on.
Yeah, you can see all this hair is popping out of his chest. But
Yeah, I guess so.
that was very unique. And you know what I thought they were gonna do with that shopping mall is because it stood out like a sore thumb, and my mind was like, man, this is the first time we've ever seen like outside that wasn't like destroyed, or you know what I mean? It was just them like walking outside, and it looked like normal. Like, and I was like, I wonder if Buck had brought this, you know, shopping mall idea to this time period.
Did you get I got the impression that it was still indoors though, or that's why it was,
I
and I
didn't
don't
get
know if that
I
was
did not
intense.
I did not get the impression, but did you see something that would indicate it was still indoors?
No, I don't know if it was that was intentional or if it was just the fact that it was obviously on set. So
Yeah.
it was actually, and you could tell it was actually in a building, just like It wasn't the greatest set that we've seen on the show, but I don't know if that was a product of that and that they were intending it to look like it was outside, or because, like you said, any exterior shots we've seen is that the earth is not in that great a condition. So I
Yeah.
almost thought that it was an interior location that was they had still had some like artificial effects and stuff like that to make it feel a little bit more homey and outdoors. But either way, out in amongst the crowd, Buck sees this woman that looks just like his ex-girlfriend. I like that Twiggy doesn't know what's going on, and he just shakes his head and says, "A pretty girl, and it's off to the races." As Buck just takes off,
Yeah, because
so.
he's shopping with Twiggy, and it's a weird shopping thing because Twiggy's in the front. Like,
Yeah.
usually Twiggy can't keep up with Buck, and like Twiggy's like running with the shopping bags, and he's like, "Buck, can't you keep up?" Or, and then he sees the woman, and then it's kind of like that's where the plot steers because we see her like three, like maybe two or three more times. What one of them, Buck's trying to chase her down at a spaceport. It's like almost like she's leaving for a flight, and
Yeah.
he's like, I gotta find her, and he like calls her, and she just looks back, and she gets on her flight, and they're like, sorry, sir, the plane's leaving, you know, the shuttle's leaving, you can't get on this, so he doesn't go back to track her down, but I missed this one part because I stepped away off the elliptical to let Harley out, but. All of a sudden, I came back, and he was talking to the airline attendant, the one that was running the counter, plus maybe like the guy that's in charge. And he's like, "Can you find out who this woman is? Did he like display his badge or anything? Like, I'm Defense Directorate, or you know, like."
Yeah, what happened was the woman at the desk, she said that she couldn't really help him, normal security kind of things, like I can't just tell you who a passenger is. And he was getting frustrated. He was about to leave, and then the guy that was at the desk recognized him as Buck Rogers. He's
Yeah.
like, "Wait a minute, aren't you so and so?" And so, when they realized who he was, he told the woman at the counter to go ahead and give him whatever information that he needed.
I was hoping that was the case and it wasn't like a secured like, "Oh,
A
Joe
security
Blow,
breach.
yeah, I'll let you in and let you know all my passenger itinerary."
Yeah.
And they had pictures of her and everything. So there goes Skype. It like just zaps out for a couple
Essentially,
seconds. I zapped out for a couple seconds.
okay, yeah, it
You were
broke up a
saying
little there.
essentially.
Essentially, they find her in their database based on his physical description.
Yeah.
So I guess they take a lot of information from you when they when you book a flight, because he doesn't know anything about her because he doesn't know what her real name is. So he just says, "She looks kind of like this," and she taps some keys, and they're like, "Is this her?" And they have a picture of her.
So
So,
he takes that information back to Dr. Ewer and he's like, "Do you have any information on her?" And they pretty much don't. They kind of give her information. Here's her name, here's where she might be visiting here and that kind of information, but she was heading to like New Orleans, which is called City on the Sea.
yeah.
So Buck said that's where they have that intimate conversation about Ewer's wife and he said, I need a leave of absence. I need to go find out what's going on with this woman." And he leaves to go to the city on the sea. Meanwhile, you hear the plot of the red-faced villains that they have made this woman or this agent of theirs into to look exactly like Buck's ex-girlfriend for a reason. And that's a pretty complicated reason. I really like that plot. It was kind of crazy 'cause it was almost like they could foresee what the director was going to do. Do you know what I mean? Ahead of time before they even did it. Which made it really interesting, but City of the Sea was so bizarre. It looked like the shittiest New Orleans that I've ever seen. It's like you have magic has regressed, gymnastics has regressed, everything has gotten worse. You just got people doing handstands in the street.
It's a really weird circus, and I swear that this set was set up same building or wherever that they had the shopping mall in the beginning. Like it
It
had the same
probably
light
was.
quality, and it just seemed like the same place. But it's like this weird circus, and supposedly what's going on at this time, there's a passing remark at some point that it's the Festival of Masks. So there
Mardi
was a
Gras.
reason, yeah, that people were walking around with these masks on stuff. But yeah, this is where Buck runs into one of the worst magicians around, and this guy decides to do a magic show for Buck, and people are pretty interested. The crowds around, they pretty big crowd. I noticed one guy. There's a guy who's got a woman on his shoulders that walks up, and he's an extra in the background, and you can see him mouth, "Hey, a magic trick."
I didn't see that part. I
I
didn't
happen to
notice
just be looking in the right spot or whatever. It was kind of
it.
funny, but
But
yeah, this
he
guy
was
sucks
also
at
like a
magic.
psychiatrist because he sat there with Buck, and Buck was like contemplating life and the future and all this in the past. He's like, "You can't live in the past. You have to move forward and
Yeah, they
go
do
into
have
the
a
future."
talk for a while.
Yeah, they have a talk, and then he breaks out into his magic trick, which is like, "I'm gonna make a bouquet of fruit." And it turns out to be flowers, and they're like really cheesy tricks, like somebody like a 10-year-old today or 8-year-old could do. He's got like this huge drape or like a thing that he has things behind. It looks like a bag at some point where he's just pulling shit out of the bag and saying, "Ooh, it's magic." And then he's like, "Oh, I'm gonna pull out like this bird and let it fly away," and it's like this dead bird, and it just goes thump. It
It
just
just
gets like.
flaps on the ground, and then there's this really awkward cut. I thought like my DVD skipped or something, because you see the dead bird hit the ground, and then there's just this really rough cut to the next scene. I thought
There's no transition whatsoever.
yeah, there was
It's
no
like
transition.
you're doing magic, and then the dead bird goes thump, and then Buck's walking again. And that's where he runs into Layla again.
Yeah, it was really, I thought I missed something, or like it was just strange. But yeah, he finally catches up with Layla, and this is where he finally gets a sense of who she is, and she f ends up falling for him, because no woman can resist Buck Rogers.
All he has
And
to do is say a few words, and it's like, wow,
they're done.
yeah, because he's a handsome ass man. His physique is so damn hot.
And he's got that chest hair popping out, and
Yeah.
all he's got to do is just look at them, and they're taking off their pants. Pretty much so.
But she falls for him over one date. Like, she's like, I can't betray Buck now. So when the red face people come to take Buck with them because they need him for this mission, they actually start. Buck starts with his karate chops. Buck's karate kicks are so awesome because he could like turn the whole situation around with one kick. Nobody else could do that. He could just kick the gun out and then he's in control of the situation.
It's actually as if there's some kind of energy force that surrounds his foot,
Yeah.
and he can just like sweep over a whole crowd of dudes by swinging his leg in their direction. But
It's like Gorgon from the Inhumans with the
yeah.
hook, with the powered hoof, man. It's like start an earthquake with it. So they fight, and then Layla lets him know. They actually knock them out, and they run away. And Layla's like, "Here's what happened. I'm not Jennifer. They've used some kind of masking technology to give me this face to make him look like." And then she said, "This is how they got your face. When you were off world one time, they broke into your apartment and saw pictures of Jennifer, and then they made my face look like it." And she feels really guilty and stuff. And Buck's like, at the time, he looks like he's angry about the whole situation. But as soon as she starts crying and hugs him and kisses him, it's all over.
Yeah, and that seemed. I always had the impression that Buck's apartment was in the same complex with in
Wilma and them.
Wilma and all that stuff. It seems like, and so it seems like the security would be a little bit better they could have just broken into his apartment, sounds like,
Yeah, maybe
but they
those
had
red
to.
face guys have some kind of technology that.
Yeah, but they had to know somehow, so I guess that's, that works. But and I will say that.
His apartment did look bigger too. Like we got a scope of where he sleeps. He looked like he had a little staircase there. He had this like shelf with nothing on it but one picture. It was like a whole, it had like all these different shelves, and all that was on it was the one picture of Jennifer.
Yeah, they didn't have like the
You
set
think he'd have
design to
some,
have chance.
you think he'd have some plants or something in there, you know? Like this
Yeah.
is a real plant lover. He just has
That
one
was
picture in that whole case.
one case where they did have some technology down, like some idea of futuristic technology, because apparently he can just walk in there and say, "I want to sleep," and the stuff starts shifting around and his bed gets ready
Yeah.
automatically. So they had kind of that thing. They imagined that, but not that I have that set up in my house, but I think that technology is like Microsoft Home and stuff like that, where they want to be able to just talk to your house.
Yeah.
But and I will say that when you say that the Coven are red-skinned people, being very literal, it's not, they don't have just a sunburn or something. Their skin is crimson red,
Yeah, it's bright, bright red. A
bright red.
lot of makeup.
Layla admits that she pretty much did it for the money.
Yeah, and Layla has a transmitter in her, unfortunately. So that leads the aliens, the coven, or whatever they call themselves, to Layla and Buck.
Yeah, that's, they put it in there when they did the surgery to make her look like Jennifer, apparently. But the Coven, they apparently they want Buck. So the Coven, they're in a conflict with this group. I thought I wrote it down, this other group that
I thought it was
the
somebody in the Vega system or
yeah, there
something
you
like
go.
that.
Vega, they're at war with the Vega 5, Vega V colony. And Earth is going to be giving weapons to the Vega 5 colony to fight the Coven.
They want to help them fight the Coven, but there's like politics involved. It's kind of like if we were to go to the Middle East or something. There's stuff you can't just go do stuff. You have to work around like the United Nations and all this stuff. The only thing they can do is provide supplies. They can supply weapons, they can supply food, they can supply whatever they need to help this Vega 5 defend themselves against this these red-faced villains. So that's where the plot got kind of cool is they I just don't know how the red face guys anticipated this was going to happen. Like they had to have somebody undercover there saying, "Hey, they're going to ship medical supplies and weapons to Vega, so you got to stop them." So, "Oh, how are we going to stop them? We need to get Buck to shoot that." And because supplies are not supposed to be human manned. In other words, they usually send them via droids. In other words, droids fly the ship there, they drop the equipment off, and then fly back. But in this case, Wilma, and she has like six fighter pilots with them, had mocked up this old shuttle to have some like fighter capabilities and stuff like that. And they went off on this mission. Meanwhile, they say, "Buck, this is what your plan is. We're going to keep Layla here, and we'll kill her if you go away from the plan, and we'll send her up. We'll send you up with Nola, who's the red-faced woman, which she has a. I don't know what Buck has with him. He must have these like pheromones that just make like these women like so horny, because she's like a villain, and she's like, you're a sexy man. You know, I could treat you like a woman should treat you. You could go with this weak ass Jennifer woman. I'll bang your rod so hard that you won't know what hit you." She kind of like does that stuff, and Buck's like, "You're not my type." If it was Kirk, he'd say, "Let's go do that, and then I'll betray you later."
Yeah, it's not just human women. It's women of any species.
Yeah.
Yeah, I I guess assumed that they got the information on the freighter through some sort of, like you said, some sort of espionage, or they intercepted a message somewhere or something. But yeah, their plan is to they get near the freighter, Buck and Nola, and then they issue a code blue distress signal. And Nola's sort of skeptical, but she seems pretty impressed when this plan works. They receive the signal in the freighter, and
And Buck says, "You can't handle the truth."
Wilma says,
Always think of the, every time I hear Code Blue, I think of Code Red and that one Tom Cruise film.
Oh, okay.
A
I
few
was wondering
good.
what the connection was there.
I always think of that scene where it's Jack Nicholson on the
Right.
stage.
Yeah.
Did you issue a Code Red? You can't handle the truth.
Good old Tom Cruise.
Yeah. Your favorite.
Oh my gosh. You know, I posted that a while back on Facebook that I didn't care for him, and then I got some blowback from that. People were like, "Oh, he's not, blah blah blah," and I kind of gave in a little bit. But then I read a—I won't get into it—but I read a book this week about by the niece. Her name's Jennifer Miscavige Hill, and she's the niece of the leader of Scientology.
Yeah.
And after reading that book,
You don't
I'm
like Tom
back to where
Cruise,
I'm
you don't
at.
like
Yeah, I
him.
was back to where I was at.
Stick to your guns, man.
Yeah,
I mean.
I'm going to. But anyways, so yeah, this plan works because Wilma, they try to hail Buck's ship and they don't get a response. But Wilma says, "Well, their comm system's probably out if they're issuing a code blue distress." She's conflicted. They're not really supposed to respond to any signals, but she can't bring herself to leave somebody that needs help. So she issues the command to pull the ship in and tractor beam. And they actually send androids down to greet whoever is on the ship. So at first, Buck and Nola think that what they were still think that the ship is manned by only androids, but then Wilma shows up and Buck's shocked to see her. They end up Buck kind of makes some eye signals towards her because Nola tells Wilma to put her weapon down, and she grabs Buck as if she's going to shoot him and stuff. But Wilma and Buck communicate through a look, and they get the jump on Nola and take her out. So then at that point they team up, and they know that the Coven are monitoring to see that they're expecting at a certain point that there's going to be an explosion, but they know that their technology is not so great that they won't be able to tell the difference between the ship exploding and say an asteroid exploding. That'll be like a similar explosion, and they'll just be that's all they'll be able to tell, or at least that's what they're suspecting. So they end up blowing up an asteroid instead. It seems to work at first, but Layla ends up Layla, she's still back with the Coven, and she thinks, okay, they're gonna honor their deal. I did what I was supposed to do, and she wants to actually leave and go with Buck. And the leader of the Coven's like, "Uh-uh, that's not going to happen. You're not going with Buck after all this is done, said and done." So when Buck comes back, he tries to save her from the Coven, but they say, "This transmitter we put in her, it can't be removed, so you'll never be able to escape us. We'll always be able to find her." And the conflict ends up turning into a shootout. And I was actually kind of surprised. Most episodes that we've had, I would say, ended on a pretty happy ending. But at this point, Layla's shot in the shootout and she dies.
Yeah, it's more of an emotional, serious take because of the whole nature of him losing his soon-to-be woman, or his soulmate, and then her coming back, and then the whole scene with Dr. Ewer. It was kind of a dark take. And did you happen to notice when Buck was leaving for New Orleans, that did you notice Wilma's expression? Like when he says, "Do you think, she's asking you, or do you think she'll find her, or his love, or whatever?" And then she makes this like sigh, like she might still have feelings for him. Did you notice that, or was it just, it really stood out like for me.
I didn't catch it, but it certainly seems possible. I mean, I've always thought that they would,
Well, they made it look like more like a friendship, but then this one little discussion happened, and her reaction was like, "Well, I guess my chances are gonna go away," kind of thing. It was weird.
Yeah. No, I've always been surprised that they haven't played up a romance between the two of them more than they have. So, I just realized one other thing that I wanted to make note of is that this episode was written by Alan Brennert. And he's actually written a bunch of other episodes that we've covered, mostly co-writing. He did write both episodes of The Plot to Kill a City, which was episode 6 and 7 that we covered a long time ago. But he's pretty well known. He hasn't done a lot of comic book writing, but the little bit that he's done, other than television writing, he's known as a novelist, but he's done some pretty prominently remembered comics for DC, particularly Brian Reigate, that we've a friend of the show and podcaster with Comics and History. He had an episode where he talked about one of Alan Brennert's stories. I think it was Detective Comics 500. That is a favorite of his, and he also wrote some really well remembered issues of The Brave and the Bold that another podcast that's talked about him, and actually I think they're the ones that had an interview with him was is the Fire and Water podcast. So he hasn't done a lot of comic book writing, but apparently the stuff that he wrote
Well received.
is really well received and remembered by people. So that's pretty cool. Comic book connection there. Retro comics even. But yeah, so and I did like that they do have their kind of ending of the episode where it's sort of a bit of a joke to end the episode, but I like that they didn't the they tell you that Buck's taken a 3-week vacation to recover from the whole situation. I thought that was a nice touch because emotionally, it wouldn't have really flowed for him to just be like jovial and joking around the next day, from the tragedy of the situation. But our stinger for the end of the episode is that to sort of cheer him up and stuff like that, Dr. Huer has been able to find a movie from back in Buck's day. He doesn't really know what it is. He says, I think it's must be some kind of nature documentary, and you could tell that Buck's disappointed at that point. He's like, "Oh, well, I thought you found like a real movie, and Dr. Huer says, "Oh, he's like, I don't even remember the name. I think it's something like Mouth or Mandible or something." And Buck's like, "Jaws?"
And then did you hear the music at the end? It did like a Jaws theme.
Did it? No, I didn't hear that. But I
It
did.
was like a
Bucky,
sci-fi
the
version of it.
Bucky.
It was like, did it, did it,
Nice.
did it, did it. The
Yeah, and
music.
Twiggy is apparently pretty. He's been studying up on his 20th century cinema because he says just when you thought it was safe in the 25th century.
And that's when everybody laughs.
Yeah. So they all, I guess they think, I guess Wilma and Dr. Huer, for some reason know the Jaws catch line. But it was that was kind of cute. I actually meant to. So this was broadcast on February 14th, 1980, and I wanted to see
How
Jaws was
Jaws was.
75, so it's about 5 years old at that point.
Well known, though. It's a
Oh
well-known. When
yeah.
you say
Oh yeah.
Jaws, people know what that is.
Yeah, I mean it was huge even, I mean it was huge when it came out. Not that I
Spawned
remember, but
many
as
sequels.
I've read. Yeah, I haven't seen any of the sequels. I've seen and really I really enjoy Jaws. I think it's a really cool film.
I saw Jaws 2 is really good. I've also, I don't even know if they still have this, but Universal Studios used to go on that tour van and
Oh
it
yeah.
would drive in the water. Speaking of retro, the two things I remember a lot about that tour van was it would take you through the in the $6 Million Man, there's a circular like ice cave or whatever that they go through where he fights Bigfoot and stuff, and the tour van would go through that. They probably don't have that anymore. And then the other thing that it would do back when I was a kid is you'd go through the water and you'd go through the you would actually the thing would submerse itself like in the water a little bit, and then you'd hear like music da 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 da, and this mechanical shark would just pop up and get you wet and stuff. Right near the van. It was pretty cool. And then
Nice.
the other thing that it did, that speaking of retro, was they had this is kind of when I was a kid too, so it's a long time ago. I don't know what it's like now. This was in the LA or the California one. And then the other thing they had was you would go into this Cylon ship, and they would pretend they were going to capture the whole shuttle that you were in and take you up into space, and then all of a sudden these actors come in dressed like Starbuck and Apollo, and they shoot the Cylons, and then you go to the next scene. It's pretty cool shit. I would love to see that again as an adult, but when I saw it as a kid, it was like absolutely fascinating.
Yeah.
I was
Yeah,
like
sometimes it
blown
doesn't hold
away.
up, but
Because I was so, as a kid, I was so into that pop culture. Like, I was so into the Battlestar Galactica. I was so into the $6 Million Man and stuff like that, that it was such a big deal to see that as a kid, you know?
Yeah. It's a weird connection, but one I it reminded me of going up to there's this place called Canada's Wonderland,
Yeah.
and it's in Ontario. I think it's actually I'm trying to think if it's north of Toronto or, but it's up that way anyways, and they that it's a theme park, and they have at least they did back in the day, they had Hanna-Barbera stuff, you know, so you'd have Hanna-Barbera characters walking around and stuff, and that I always used to think that was awesome when we went up a few times when I was a kid. I used to like them walking around and stuff, but they had the Smurf Village, and you'd walk through this. It was just a walkthrough thing, and they had all these ceramic Smurfs set up in like dioramas and stuff like that. And when we went up one time, it was my mom and her friend, and me and my sister, and then my mom's friend's son, who was like 4 years older than me. So he was like a young teen or something at that time. And he brought a friend of his with him that was the same age. So they ended up going off and doing their own thing because they were at that age. They didn't want to be with, you know, adults. And next thing, so we're there for a little while. Next thing we know, we're getting escorted out of the park because the friend that he bought kicked one of the ceramic Smurfs' heads in. He kicked it and smashed the ceramic head in, and so all of us had to leave.
You're escorted out.
We were escorted out, and we all had to leave. And
Smurf
man.
killers.
We were like, my sister and I were like super upset. My sister was crying, and
Who was the one that kicked it in?
it was my mom's
Friend's
friend's
son.
son's
Okay.
friend.
Oh, okay. It
Not her
wasn't
son,
the
but
her
her son's
son.
friend,
Okay, a
yeah.
son's friend. So he was like the one that was latching on to the two families to go onto this amusement park.
Yeah, he was brought along. You know, like you're at
And
that age, like
ended up getting you kicked out. That sucks.
I gotta see if next time I see my mom's friend, I gotta ask her what his name was. I
You
gotta
gotta
track
tr
him down.
track him down.
Give him a piece of my mind. I
We'll
wonder if he's on
call him
Twitter.
up on Skype.
Yeah.
Does he have a Skype account?
It's like I need to clear the air between us. I got a bone to pick with you. You deprived me of some Yogi
Smarts.
Bear time.
Yeah, Yogi Bear. Another boo-boo. What does he say about boo-boo?
Hey boo boo. I think it's just hey boo boo.
Hey,
Hey boo boo.
boo-boo.
Boo boo,
I
it's the little
actually
bear.
don't know of all the different cartoons, the Yogi Bear and Huckleberry Hound and some of
Flintstones.
those. The Flintstones are an exception, but I didn't really watch a lot of Yogi Bear until like USA Network had it or something, and repeats. And same with Huckleberry Hound, the Cartoon Network. But like, if it's the Flintstones, I know the Flintstones and the Jetsons like by heart. I watched every episode, I think. And
Those are the
almost
ones I knew the most,
in every
too.
incarnation, you know.
Yeah,
But
I mean, I
I
knew.
didn't know like that offshoot of characters that were
Yeah.
somewhat popular, like Yogi and Huckleberry Hound and some of those characters that are a
Yeah.
little more obscure, but they're popular. Like Yogi Bear had his own movie. So
No, I mean, I knew the Flintstones and the Jetsons the most, but you would see some of the other ones too, like you said, Huckleberry Hound and
was that
Yogi
park called? I'm
Bear,
gonna put it in the show notes.
Canada's Wonderland.
Canada's Wonderland.
Quick Draw McGraw, Top Cat,
Yeah, those are the ones I'm not too familiar with.
McGilla Gorilla, Secret Squirrel. Yeah. But Wacky Races, that I used to watch Wacky Races a lot.
Oh, that's where I would see him though, because
Yeah, those
Wacky
characters.
Races had the Yogi and the Laugh Olympics. They were very similar. They were was a race or one was a competition, and they would have the Yogis and the Flintstones and all the different the villains would have their own team. I just remember Muttley. He'd go he he'd be laughing all the
Yeah, they were on the race too.
the really rottens on the Laugh Olympics. I don't remember what they were on the race, but yeah, that was some good shit, man. I love that. Because back in the day, they had like the time that Laugh Olympics came out, they used to have this Battle of the Stars, the network stars, and I absolutely love this fucking show. This is where they took like the actors like Lee Majors and all the actors of the shows I like to watch, you know, you'd have somebody from Battlestar Galactica and all this stuff, and they'd do tug of war and all these like crazy competitions to see what network would win. Like, is it NBC who wins or ABC?
Oh,
It was crazy shit, but it
yeah.
was awesome.
I've seen clips of that. It was before my time, but
Yeah. It's like a stream of consciousness of things that are just leading off a thing, you know. Speaking of that, I just love that show. It was so bizarre, but it was something I always liked to watch because even though the actor I knew they were actors, I still thought of them as, hey, you know, that's a $6 million man, or
Yeah.
how
Oh, you know what
are
else?
they gonna lose the tug of war? Or if they had like Lou Ferrigno or somebody, if you put him as the anchor, how are you gonna lose the tug of war?
Yeah. Do you remember Blue Falcon and Dynamutt?
Loved Blue Falcon and Dynamutt. I absolutely love that show.
So they were another one. They were Hanna-Barbera.
Yeah. There's a lot of Hanna-Barbera I was aware of, but I think I'm more aware of the popular ones that had like many seasons, you know.
But yeah, Blue Falcon was totally like Batman.
Yeah. It was like Batman. The dog was like a goofy Scooby-Doo. A matter of fact, I think they always treated him like cousins. I think they
Yeah,
had
he
a team
is.
up with Scooby had a couple of dog cousins, and I can't remember all of them, but I think that was like treated like family to Scooby-Doo.
Yeah, as time went on, they kept adding Scooby, new more relatives to Scooby.
Yeah.
But Scooby, the Smurfs, the Snorks were like the underwater version of the Smurfs.
Yeah, and that's when I
Shirt
kind of lost
Tales.
me. Those ones are the ones that kind of lost me. I watched the Smurfs for one sole reason. It was the cartoon right before Spider-Man and His Amazing Friends. I never got into that, but like I know Knutson's into the Smurfs. He even has some.
Oh, right, yeah.
I have a cousin in
'Cause they're really
California
big
that
in
was
Germany
so
too.
into those Smurfs. Like she collected every one of those little ones.
Yeah,
So.
when you get into some of those ones, you're talking more like the 80s at that point.
Yeah.
Like I saw a lot of the 70s stuff on reruns because they would rerun it like crazy, but you're getting into the 80s when you talk about the Smurfs and the Snorks and Shirt Tales.
Yeah.
I saw Shirt Tales a lot. But then in the late 80s is when they like them and everybody else they got into like doing the baby versions of every fucking thing.
A baby Muppets, baby.
Flintstone Kids,
Flintstone Kids, yeah.
pup named Scooby-Doo. They even had fucking Popeye and Son. It's like Pound Puppies. My sister was super into the Pound Puppies.
Yeah.
Muppet Babies, that wasn't Hanna-Barbera, of course, but they were doing, everything. Disney Babies.
Yeah. Never watched any of
Freaking.
it 'cause I just wasn't interested. But
Yeah.
I was older too at the time, so my
Yeah.
tastes and cartoons had changed.
We did watch Muppet Babies, I'll say that, but.
Yeah. It's probably one of the more popular ones.
My sister had a baby Fozzie doll, I remember.
Nice.
Yeah. I used to throw tomatoes at it. No, just kidding. Little Muppet humor for
Yeah.
Daryl.
So we have one question from Brian. Speaking of Brian, you mentioned him earlier. This
Oh
came
yeah, I wonder if
just.
he probably he's Canadian. I wonder if he went to Canada's Wonderland, probably.
Yeah. He sent this question for the last episode.
Oh, I'm glad you remembered
He
that.
sent it last. What I try to do is, if we don't get to the questions, I try to save them on my desktop so I remember to address them. Because I never know when they'll come in.
Yeah.
But he's got a good question. He says, "What are your favorite past comic book marriages or significant relationships?" And he mentions like Alan Scott and his wife and Jay and Joan. Mine would be Wally and Linda. That one was a big one because of the Speed Force, and even their love has kind of like saved him from being absorbed by the Speed Force. It would be able to pull him back. But that was a big one because it's probably a big one for you too, because The Flash is one of the collections that you almost have the whole run.
Yeah, that would be probably the any other ones I would think of probably would be ones that would go back to reading comics when I was a kid, but that was one that I read more as an adult and saw develop. And yeah, I mean, I do miss that reading that relationship in comics because I mean, so much of Wally's life was through comics, or what I mean is you saw him grow up. You could read most of his history actually over time through comics. And so, you saw them date and even you had even seen him with previous relationships and stuff like that. And you had that history, but yeah, you saw them date and then you got to like in the Geoff Johns run, you got to read a lot of their relationship and even them having kids and then see those kids get a little bit older and when the where that status was kind of was left off when the new 52 launched was they were kind of one of the few families in terms of having little kids that were. It kind of almost reminds me of like Animal Man a little bit.
That's another family, like a family unit that was well defined.
Yeah, that would be another one I'd say as like as an adult that I became familiar with both like in the original Animal Man series and I like that in the New 52 also.
Yeah.
Animal Man's family, his relationship with his wife, is a good one. But growing up, it was always Peter and Mary Jane was the one that I knew the most and connected with the most. Well, not connected with, but I guess what I mean is.
That is a big one. I mean, a lot of people don't like Mary Jane that came out of the Bronze Age, but I know I didn't read too much Spider-Man in the Bronze Age, so like Gwen
Me
Stacy
neither.
came like way later, but my Spider-Man was always him and Mary Jane. And
Yeah, me
I
too.
always like I always liked Mary Jane. Like I've never not liked her. I hear a lot of other podcasts slam Mary Jane, but I've always liked her as a character.
I guess it's all where you come into it. I like you said, I when I started reading Spider-Man, he was already married to her, so
Yeah.
and I don't think it hurt that when I was reading Spider-Man drawn by Eric Larson, and so seeing Mary Jane as drawn by Eric Larson when I was going through puberty, so I don't think that hurt either because he
Or
had it.
McFarlane,
And
like
McFarlane, yeah,
he would
McFarlane
draw
and.
like McFarlane. There was some great artists that came on Spider-Man in that time.
And that's the time period, like right towards the end of McFarlane, and then all of when I had a subscription to Amazing Spider-Man, it was when Eric Larson was drawing it, and like he definitely played up the like supermodel aspect of Mary Jane,
Yeah.
which and like I said, I given the age I was at the time, I took to that pretty well.
Well, they even when she was a model, she never seemed to me like to be like one of those brain dead models. Do you know what I mean?
Oh no, not at all.
She definitely had character and spirit and stuff like that behind her character, so
No, they didn't characterize her that way, no.
yeah,
And
I like that.
there was always a lot about I think to me at least it always came across the amount of support that she like it was always expressed the way that their relationship was a huge place of support and
Yeah.
security for Peter.
You could
But
talk about
they were in it together, kind of, you know.
yeah. I mean this question could just spawn a whole episode, 'cause if you talk relationships, it doesn't have to be like a romantic relationship. It could be like Blue Beetle and Booster, or Luke Cage and Iron Fist, you know? So.
Yeah, you could do a takeoff like that, yeah.
Yeah, and the Fantastic Four has always been a good family stuff. The only thing I don't that drive me crazy with the Fantastic Four is Reed is so mechanical and scientific that I think he ignores Sue and it drives me crazy. But as a family unit, they're pretty close. Like, you know, the relationships between Ben, like Ben isn't even blood, and he is kind of like with that family, like.
Sure.
And then you could get into the Ben and Alicia thing, you know? That was a huge relationship.
Yeah, that's true.
And you got Lois and Clark. You can't throw that one out. Bruce has had many loves in his life as well.
Yeah, did you like was 'cause I didn't grow up with DC and I still have never been a huge Superman guy. Was that ever meaningful to you, the Lois and Clark relationship? Did you ever really care about that much, or I mean, I was aware of it, of course, from like the TV show and stuff, but I never read Superman back in the
Yeah,
day, and it.
the wedding and stuff was pretty meaningful to me. Yeah. And like the
That's cool.
reveal, like when she finds out he's finally Superman after all those years.
Right.
Yeah, I enjoyed those issues quite a bit.
That's cool.
And the Lana one I've never understood, even though they keep pointing it out because I just wasn't there for it, you know, the high school stuff. But yeah,
Yeah,
there's the
with
Catwoman
Batman,
and
there's
Batman. There's
that's the only one I think really. I don't.
that one always comes back. Do you know what I
Yeah.
mean? There's always women in his life, like reporters and his bodyguard even one time. There's always been these like relationships, but they come and go. The one that Kevin Smith brought back, I forget what her name was, the girl with the white hair. She was huge, like in the 80s. Like that relationship was big time.
Isn't it Saint something, Saint
Yeah,
Cloud
Saint
or
Cloud. Yeah, whatever her name is. There's so much you can talk about, like Dick Grayson, all the loves of his life, like him and Barbara. That's got to be a big one. But Barbara's the only one that's like always been there. Like, but Dick has been with like everybody. You can even say Dick and Starfire, you know, like if you were in the Titans time period, you could say that Garth and Cyborg were a great relationship between the two of them, you know.
Going back to Batman, I thought it was interesting to talk to my mom about the first episode of Gotham.
That was
The
fascinating to see that your mom knew those characters. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, and I
My parents didn't know. I mean, my parents know Commissioner Gordon, and then it probably ended. Like they didn't get the Edward Nygma or the Cobblepot, you know what I mean?
Yeah, I hadn't thought about it, but she did watch the Batman 60s show growing up,
Yeah.
so a lot of her reference points are from that. So it was kind of interesting to talk to her. We actually went over there last night, and to hear what she like what references she did have, and that a lot of them, she was aware of, like any ones that were back around back in the 60s. She picked up, I asked her if she picked up on Edward Nygma being the Riddler, and she had that and Cobblepot, but I didn't realize that she would know Poison Ivy. She actually picked up on that little
Oh,
girl
the
being
little
Poison
girl,
Ivy.
yeah, the little girl reference, Ivy, and there I had to do a double take because I was like, why is Ivy with this criminal dude, you know? But then they like really point out, like when she brings all those plants, like she's holding all those freaking plants.
Some of it was a little bit like they were wanting to make sure they got it across to people
They
that don't know it
wanted
too
to.
well.
I really liked the transformation of like Penguin, like. He looked like the Penguin, but he wasn't like all stocky and stuff. And you could see how he like could form his waddle and stuff, you know, just by the story plot. But yeah, it was good stuff.
But yeah, it was pretty cool to, but what made me think of it is that I didn't realize that she would have a reference point to Batman and Catwoman, but I guess because I've only seen random episodes of the 60s TV show, so
Yeah.
I didn't realize it that she would know Poison Ivy, and I also didn't realize that she would know that there was like that history with Catwoman, but she brought that up when she said that she liked how that they had Catwoman witnessing the Waynes getting killed and sort of lurking in the background and showing an interest in Bruce Wayne.
Yeah.
So yeah, I thought that was kind of neat. But good
Oh,
question.
Swamp Thing. Swamp Thing and Abby, that's a hardcore relationship there.
Oh
There's so many of them. I mean, all you have to
yeah.
do is take a character and you can find some love interest at some point.
Yeah, enough that everybody could have a favorite.
Yeah. There's Betty and Bruce. for the Hulk.
True.
There's Kyle. He's had so many women, it's not a bit funny. Kyle's been with Donna. He's been with Jade. He's
I don't think there's any, for me, there's no one that I really connect with him prominently, though.
They were interesting relationships, though, I'll tell you that.
Yeah.
None of them lasted very long, but they were kind of intimate at some level. You know what I mean?
Yeah, there's just not one that sort of outshines the others to me, I guess. So, I mean.
Aquaman and Mera.
Yeah, that's one I really only become familiar with. I mean, I was aware of it, but never meant anything to me until the New 52, because I never really read much Aquaman prior to the New 52. Whereas in the New 52, that's I like it a lot.
Ooh, Hawkman and Hawkgirl, their whole history when Geoff Johns took over is based on their relationship throughout
That's
time.
true.
It's a love throughout time that's never ending. That was a fascinating relationship. Ollie and Black Canary.
Yeah,
Holy
that's a big
shit.
one.
Ollie and Hal. That's a great relationship there. I mean, I could talk about this in a whole episode, but we
Yeah.
gotta get to comics.
Yeah.
Maybe we can
Especially
continue
spreading
our
it out to
discussion
just.
if we don't get any questions for next time. Maybe we can just expand upon it.
Yeah. Yeah, we can go more into the bromances that you're mentioning. Well, you can. I'll let you start off with one.
Okay, I'll start off with the one I like the least, and then work my way forward. So, these are books that I didn't have in my collection, and I needed to get, with the exception of John Sable. In other words, I had collected Team Titans all the way through 1 through 16 and didn't have 17 to completion. So, I picked up Team Titans number 17 to complete my list, which was published in February 1994. And the writer on this, I believe, is Phil Jimenez. Let me see if I can get the creative team, which is cool because I think he did art and story. Writers are Jeff Jensen, who I haven't heard too much, and Phil Jimenez was credited as writing as which he, I know Phil Jimenez a lot from his writing on Wonder Woman. He took over eventually. He's a huge Wonder Woman fan. The inkers were Will Blyberg and Charles Barnett. And Terry Dodson did the cover. Oh no, Terry Dodson was the penciler on this. He didn't write, it wasn't Phil Jimenez. It was Terry Dodson. So he did the cover, I knew for sure. And Terry Dodson's kind of a big artist today. At least he's well known. But this team of Teen Titans has a vampire named Knight Rider. He's got a guy that looks very much like the Forever People character called Battalion. He just he, Terra, who's probably the more well-known one, Red Wing, Donna, and her boy, her husband was in it, Terry, and Kilowatt, who has powers of like electricity, and it opens up with Knight Rider suffering from some beating he took, and they need to get him to Star Labs to get him healed. He got caught eating cattle at this guy's farm, and this guy pretty much took him out. And he's like, "I'm sorry, he was eating your cattle, but he needed to feed." And Terry says something like, "It's not your fault. You had the right idea. He was eating your livestock." And Terra gets really pissed off. "I can't believe you. We have one of our teammates bleeding to death over here, and you're sticking up for this farmer guy who shot him for taking away the cattle." And Terry and Donna have this little baby at this time, and he's crying the whole time they're having this discussion. And then they have Red Wing. I forgot to mention her. But that consists of the team. So they have to get most of the team is gonna fly Knight Rider out. And it's not like Knight Rider from the TV show. This is a vampire Knight Rider. They're flying him out to Star Labs to get healed. And meanwhile, these elementals, which looks like ice, like earth, fire, and what is the other elemental? I can't remember.
Earth,
Earth
wind, fire,
and fire,
air.
air,
Or
yeah.
I mean, earth, wind, fire, ice.
Okay, I got ice, fire, earth, so the other one must be air.
Yeah.
So they're these elementals, and they really have no form. They're looking to attack Terra because she they think she's causing problems with the environment and stuff like that. So they're going to attack her. They take a Knight Rider to Star Labs and put him into a tank, and they're trying to feed him blood, and he is getting better. Kilowatt and Red Wing are there, and this weird organization decide to attack Star Labs, and they're after Kilowatt for some reason. And they take out Donna almost immediately. They take out some of the doctors, the security guards. Red Wing tries to get away, but she's taken out. They take out Battalion, and then they capture Kilowatt. And so that was the whole plot. They have to capture Kilowatt, I think, for power purposes. And then Terra's fighting the elementals. And Terry gets blasted, and you don't know what happens. As the elementals are attacking Terra, a huge grandfather clock smashes Terry as he's holding the baby, but he manages to pull the baby away, and Terry's knocked unconscious and bleed. There's like a huge puddle of blood near Terry's head, so you don't know what's going on. And somebody saves Terra from these elementals, and it turns out to be Prester John. And they mentioned Mirage, which was also a member of this team, but it's not him. She thought it was Mirage originally. And the big bad is introduced, and one of the bad guys is Deathwing, which is a weird punk rock looking Nightwing character. It's pretty controversial because he like knocks on the door of this one woman who's kind of like an archivist, and she's popular. She writes books and stuff like that, and she's an antique clockmaker, and she just happens to know the main villain in this book, and Deathwing is working for that guy. But he punches an old woman in the face, man. I'm like, God
Jeez.
dang. I know it's the 90s, but Jesus, he could have just captured her. He just clocked her right in the face. But
Jeez.
it was an interesting issue, and was something I definitely wanted to revisit because I don't remember of all the Teen Titans are incarnations. Like I love Dan Jurgens' Teen Titans, which a lot of people don't like, where the Atom could grow, and it had all those Teen Titans that they basically killed off in Infinite Crisis. And I enjoyed that team a lot, and I've enjoyed almost every incarnation of Teen Titans. And Team Titans is the one that doesn't resonate with me, so I'd like to revisit and see why, you know.
Yeah, it doesn't seem like you're the only one. I mean, I've never read any of them, but it doesn't seem like it has that great of a reputation.
Yeah. It wasn't a bad issue. It was I like comics of this era because even though I didn't remember what happened in the previous issues, I was able to pick this issue up and know like where the starting point was, and then know how it ended. Do you know what I mean? So I could continue with the story. I didn't feel like I felt they introduced all the characters to get me back into the who they were, and the time period that it was taking place. And I think they did a good job like that. And there was a lot of plot threads going on, and they all moved forward. And in that sense, it was a good story. The art was nice, because if you're a Terry Dodson fan, he does good with expressions and stuff, kind of like Maguire did with Justice League. His pencils are fairly similar to Maguire, and not as refined. I don't know. It's kind of early in his career. It's not as nice as his stuff, but it's definitely cool. So this was Terry Dodson's welcome to Team Titans. I guess his first penciled issue on this particular title.
Okay. Speaking of Terry's, is Donna's husband Terry, is he just still a normal human?
Yeah, Terry is, he's got red hair and the beard, and they have this little baby, and he's a normal human, and he's just around, like he's holding the baby the whole time while Donna tries to go help. And at this time, they give you no sense of where Donna is. Do you know what I mean? Is she Troia? Is she Wonder Girl? Is she just retired? You know what I mean? Because she's never in costume. Because Donna has had a convoluted history. You
Oh,
know,
yeah,
she
definitely.
Troia, Wonder Girl, Dark Star. She was a Dark Star for a while. She's had a lot of incarnations, and she's had her God incarnation. It gives you no sense of her power, where she is in history, other than they've had the kid, their first child, and she seems to be in charge or a mentor of this team. In other words, when she says jump, the rest of the team goes how high. She's like the kind of like guardian, I guess, of this team at this time.
Well, she would be the most experienced, it sounds like,
Yeah.
of the people on the team. But yeah, no, I was just curious because you mentioned him as being a part of the team, so it made me wonder if at some point they gave him powers or something, because I know he goes all the way back to the beginning of New Teen Titans, and I know that he was just a normal human back in the day at least, so I was just curious.
Yeah.
They changed him up or something.
No, he's just holding the baby and gets knocked out by a grandfather clock because those
Nice.
elementals attack one of the team members.
Cool. Well, to stay within DC then, as you guessed earlier, I did cover, or I did, I'm going to cover, but I did read an issue of Green Lantern. This actually continues my read of Green Lanterns that I've covered kind of all over the place, and I don't expect anybody to do this, but I did start with issue 123, which the reason I started there in reading and covering these was because that's for a long time the book was Green Lantern and Green Arrow, and that was the first issue that was just Green Lantern again. And Denny O'Neil, who had written all that stuff with Green Arrow, was still the writer on the title, but he took it back to more of a sci-fi outer space kind of book than it had been for a long time, with Hal traveling around the country with Ollie, the whole hard traveling heroes thing. So I'd read 123, 124, and 125 on and talked about them on the podcast Myth Making, etc. And then I wrote about issue 126, the one before the one I'm talking about today, on Taylor Network. So not that I expect anybody to go through all that stuff, but just to give it kind of a background. And because this issue kind of continues a story that slowly develops through those issues. At the end of 126, Hal has been trapped inside the Green Lantern power battery with all of the Guardians. And this is a big plot of the Weaponers of Kord. So that's where we pick up with this issue. It's called Battleground Oa. And like I said, it's written by Denny O'Neil. I don't think he's on the title too much longer after this, but has art by Joe Staton and Frank McLaughlin, with colors by a guy named Anthony Tolan. This came out in ni like 1980. The predicament that they've got to get out of in the beginning of the issue is being trapped in the power battery. So the Guardians mentally send a distress signal out to other Green Lanterns, and that's kind of where we get the cover, which is I think a Brian Bolland cover that has Hal, Kotmetui, bunch of other Green Lanterns. What's the name of, do you know the name of the yellow-faced Green Lantern with the fin head?
Tomar Ray?
Is that Tomar Rey?
I think so.
Okay. I know that name, but I didn't connect it with the visual, but I knew he was another prominent guy.
Yeah.
Yeah, so those are the two that I recognize at least. So they get a distress signal that they need help. So earlier in this storyline, Sinestro had been involved, and he recovers, and he shows up to the surprise of the Weaponers, and just kind of expects to take over as Sinestro is want to do. His expectation is that he was just going to be, once he was able to recover from his battle with Hal Jordan, that he was just going to be able to walk in and take over control. And he finds out that the Weaponers never really saw him that way, that they were just manipulating him and using him to their advantage. So he stomps off in a bit of a tantrum. And back at this time, yellow, the color yellow, is still a big problem for the Green Lanterns. So the Weaponers have this weapon prepared called the Yellow Vortex. It basically creates this huge whirlwind of yellow light, and that's their defense against all these incoming Green Lanterns that are responding to the distress signal. And so they're trying to fight their way through that, and they're kind of trapped. A few make it through. A few Green Lanterns are shown dying. One sort of bug-like looking alien that's a lantern. He's injured, and he's in the process of dying, but he's able to struggle his way through, and he makes it just as he's dying. He dies right in front of the power battery, to Hal's distress. But because he's able to get up to the battery, and he's got his ring in this sort of antenna, he's able to press the antenna against the power battery, and Hal's able to press his ring up against that, and that creates a conduit for the green energy, and the Guardians are able to power through that, and Hal's able to create a he's able to break out of the battery that way. So the timing's good, because that's he's able to start taking out some of the Weaponers and stuff, and he's able to disrupt the Yellow Vortex. I think it's kind of interesting scene coming up here, because given that Sinestro and Hal, their relationship has been explored a lot. Like you were just posting yesterday about recent issues of the Sinestro ongoing that they have now, that Sinestro and Hal actually team up in this issue, because Sinestro's he's like it's basically like the enemy of my enemy is my friend. He's super pissed off at the Guardians, or he's super pissed off at the Weaponers. So even though he hates the Guardians and Hal, he wants to help Hal out. So the two of them go flying in, and the two of them work together to take out General Fabricant, the leader of the weaponers and the various weaponers. Meanwhile, the rest of the Katmatui and Tomar Ray and the rest of the Guardians that are coming are able to get through the yellow vortex and actually join real battle here, with the rest of the weaponers going on outside while the main battle's going on inside. It ends kind of abruptly a little bit.
You mean
You
it
know they
completes the story, or?
yeah well I don't know what happens in the next issue, but I'm assuming that this is kind of wrapping up this whole storyline with the weaponers, it seems. It
Yeah.
just kind of, but it like the end of the issue kind of comes up suddenly. Like there's this huge battle going on and then it's over. I guess it's intentional because Hal's ready to keep fighting, and he's like, "Where's the rest of the weaponers? I'm gonna finish them off." And that some of the Guardians come up at this point and say, "There's no more. It's over. The war is won." Or well, he said they say it's no, there's no more. And Hal asks, "Then we won?" And they go into some philosophizing where they're like, "No wars are ever won, regardless who's the victor." Blah blah blah. But Hal wants to go off and find the leader of the weaponers, and Sinestro has taken off at this point. But then you see that there's the battle's taken a toll. Guardians tell Hal, "Hold up a second, we got to tend to the wounded." You see, like in the last panel, that there's all this rubble, and there's both Green Lanterns and weaponer bodies throughout the rubble. And that's how it ends on that note. So,
You mentioned some interesting things though that are kind of prevalent in the New 52 too, is the relationship between Sinestro and Hal seems sort of similar to what's happening now. Matter of fact, it comes up in the Sinestro series. Sinestro wiped out the Guardians because of what they did. With Parallax, he essentially wiped them out. And one of the things they ingrain in the New 52 is Sinestro loves Hal. Like he loves him like a brother, but he thinks he's misguided and he's untrained. It sounds like these guys are working together to fight a threat, and it seems sort of similar in their relationship to what's kind of happening now. Except Hal is in the New 52, and I know Ryan doesn't listen to this show, but I don't know how he could defend Hal in the New 52. Hal has made such stupid decisions, it's not a bit funny. And you could do a whole thesis about how stupid Hal is in this, in the New 52, and I don't know why they're consciously making him that, but I don't know if they're trying to like build him up as a character. But of all the Green Lanterns that are out there, including Kyle and John Stewart and Guy Gardner, he's the least. His brain works the least. So it's interesting. Hearing you talk about this was kind of refreshing to see that, the New 52 is, even though this is a long time ago, it's still hitting certain themes, you know what I mean? Of the past, so.
Yeah, I like this. So far, I like so. Let's see, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 5 issues of this run that right after Green Arrow left the book. I've enjoyed all 5 of these issues. It's kind of a neat return to more of a sci-fi, outer space Green Lantern, and the Joe Staton art is really good on it, and the Denny O'Neil writing. I like it. I mean, I guess this is back maybe people, their criticism would be of Hale that he's a little boring, but they're definitely, I think the characterization of him is definitely more of as a hero, and he comes across as fairly competent. He's brash a bit. Like he one of the things that happens in one of the earlier issues is that he breaks off his partnership with Green Arrow pretty abruptly, and Green Arrow's not happy about it.
Did you read about that? Like, why did he break it off?
It was intentional so that he knew that Green Arrow would do anything for him, and he really wanted Green Arrow to stay on Earth and to be used on Earth, and he felt like that was the right place for Green Arrow to be. And it was also kind of in his mind to protect Green Arrow, to make this break, as far as I can remember. But the way, at least the whole vibe that you got across was that, like, you might fault Hal's method, like the way that he went about it, but his motivation was good. Like his
Yeah.
method might not be great, but his motivation is good. And I think that it's subtle, but I like that characterization of him as a character. Like it makes him so he's not perfect. Like, but his motivation is always good, but the way that he goes about things is not always.
Sounds very similar to what they're doing with him now.
Yeah, I
He's
wonder
not,
if they're.
he's got the good intent. And he's got the right ideas. He's just making brash decisions, like they're not very calculated.
I wonder if they're going too far with it, though, because it ends up making him look stupid to a lot of people, it seems like.
It does to it's very different than your time period, that's for sure. It,
It, whereas, like, I feel
it's
like,
it's to the extreme. It's
yeah, maybe too much. Yeah. Because you don't get the sense that he's stupid back in the day. Like,
Yeah.
you think, that might not be the, but you feel like it's kind of part of his personality. Like, it's one of those things where it's his strength and his weakness. Like,
Yeah.
sometimes it does him good, sometimes it does him bad, but.
I was looking at my database and I'm missing a lot of these issues. I think I'm gonna go to my comic shop and rectify that.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say, that these issues are really cheap,
Yeah.
but they're this era hasn't been collected.
The books that I tend to have is, let's see, prior to 119. I have like a lot of issues, but and then I have a lot of issues towards the tail end to 205. But what I'm missing is kind of like the arcs that you're focusing on, which is right after the team up, you know?
Right. Yeah,
So
123 is
I
the.
have some sporadic, and there's some interesting I issues in there. Like I was. As you were talking, I was looking through there, but it looks like at some point they start having backups with Adam Strange, and I want to see what those backups are. You know, like it looks like it starts around in the 130s or something.
Okay.
And 8 pages of The Return of Adam Strange, like in 132, 133. I want to get those. I'm a huge Adam Strange fan. So, yeah. Barb's not gonna like this, but I'm gonna go shopping.
That's what people say about the show, is that when I talk about something, you check in your database.
The database is a wonderful thing 'cause I get to see all the cover. I wish I could show you it. I think you'd fall in love with this database because, oh man, it's. But the bad side is it's got like a it makes you compulsive on certain things.
Is that the comic? It's comic base that you use, right?
Yeah, comic base, yeah. It's
Yeah,
really
I've looked at that. I've almost pulled the trigger on it, and I always, I'm sure it's worth it, but I always
it's
back off on the
expensive, but
price.
if you're it's expensive and it's a yearly fee if you want the weekly subscriptions, in other words, update all the information every week. It updates prices based on stuff and all that stuff, but for somebody that has a large collection, it's really useful. It's really worth the cost. But
That's cool.
it has that thing that's bad too. I don't There's so many great covers, man. Like, I'm looking at these covers and they're f amazing.
Yes, some good
So,
stuff.
yeah. So, another series that I didn't start collecting till I think issue 12. And I don't know why. I can't tell you why. But it's Birds of Prey. And I read Birds of Prey number one, written by Chuck Dixon and Greg Land. This is the first issue of volume one. This has had like two volumes or three volumes, I can't remember. 1999. Greg Land's pencil's very different from what a Greg Land you see today. It looks like he's not using photo reference at all. It's regular pencils. The scene opens up. I think Birds of Prey had formed in like a mini series prior to this, and this is like what happens afterwards. Where are they taking this relationship forward? The relationship between Oracle and Black Canary. Black Canary. It opens up with a pretty funny scene as Oracle's trying to get Black is trying to get Dinah to use a computer, a laptop, and she just wants nothing to do with it. And she's in her pajamas and stuff, and she's like, "You can see me?" And Oracle's, "Yeah, I put a camera on that laptop. And I designed this laptop so all you have to do is hit the button to turn it on." So it's like, "You're too dumb to use the laptop. And I know you won't use it unless I make it dumb it down for you." So yeah, she's seeing everything that Dinah's doing, and she's in her PJs and she doesn't like it, 'cause she's like, if you can see me, why can't I see you?" And Oracle says, "My identity has to remain hidden. We've discussed this." And she's like, "Even from me?" So at this time, she doesn't know who she is, Barbara
Interesting.
Gordon. And so she gets a kitchen towel and she just covers the laptop so she can't see it. She can't see her anymore. And then the main plot thread here is they introduce this hellhound who's chasing two people. That thread doesn't go very far, but there's this place, this island, and it's run by a drug lord, and Dinah has to go undercover to find out what's going on. His name is Jackie Panner Jananen, and they call him Jackie Pajamas. And he's a pretty vile and rich character. And they introduce you to this other character, and you don't know his name until the very end. But he's there on a mission to help Jackie Pajamas, which means he's probably a bad guy. So Black Canary gets on Princess Patricia, which is like this nice cruise ship, heads out to the island, and Barbara's kind of like, "You got to enjoy your vacation while you're on the road there, because once you land there, it's going to be business as usual." And let's see, it kind of shows Oracle getting around the house, establishing her with her wheelchair, how hard it is to take a shower. It looks like she has like a online relationship with somebody, but at that point you don't know who it is. And then you learn that she's been hacking and using the servers of the Pentagon. Oracle's using them, and the Pentagon knows about it, but they don't know how to find her. So one of the guys is, "Let's make it our job to find out who this hacker is and who's using our memory, but we can't let the higher ups know that this is happening, or they'll make this a national incident." It's kind of like releasing the information. "Oh, we got to lock down things because so and so's hacking in." They know she's hacking in, but they don't want other people to know. So there's that plot thread. And then Black Canary's on the island. She's getting ready to attack Mr. Pajamas, and she's going through various guards to get where she needs to get. And she finds this guy's like basement, and in his basement she finds all these like Rolexes and stuff, and she's like, "What the fuck is going on here?" And then she finds body parts in jars. Like, oh shit, this guy's like killing a bunch of rich people, taking their Rolexes and taking off their ears and noses and all this stuff. She's like, "What the hell's going on here?" And then the plane lands with Jackie Pajamas or whatever with this other rich guy who's got who they purposely make an underage honey coming out with them. And Barbara tells Black Canary says it's some Anglo guy with them, and who is this? He said, "I know him." And she's like, "You do? His name is Jason Bard. He was a private investigator based in Gotham. I haven't seen him in ages. The years haven't been so kind." And then, so Jason Bard is the guy, the mysterious character that's working with this Jackie Pajamas. And she's like, "Oh, I never heard of this guy. Do you know him well?" And Barbara says, "Only if you count the time we were engaged." And the Black Canary's like, "What? Say that again?" And as she says that, it ends on a cliffhanger because two guards know that she's there spying on pajamas, and they have machine guns aimed at her right now. So we'll have to see what happens in issue two. Good issue. I was really surprised to see just because Bard is such a prevalent character in Batman Eternal. I was very, very happy to see him show up in this and again kind of establish the pre-52 Jason Bard. Although there's a lot of Jason Bard prior to this. The old Jason Bard that I read had a limp and had a cane and was a private investigator, and he was a good guy, and then later on in Detective and stuff, after this Birds of Prey, he's a good guy. And here And th at this particular time in 1999, you don't know. Other than he's dated Barbara, so he must have some kind of ethics. Because I don't think if they were engaged, I don't think Barbara would have dated him. You know what I mean? If he didn't have some ethical values, but it makes him out to be like he has a shade of gray now, and we'll see how that turns out. I love comics, man. I just love
Did
the I love the history of it, and I don't
you?
care that things change. It's just such a refreshing medium. I just love this shit.
Did you know that Jason Bard was in this issue when you decided to read it, or?
No, I just picked it out of a box. I love Of all the shows I have, I do a lot of podcasts. This one is the most fun to prep for. Because the other ones I don't necessarily know what I'm going to pick, but this one I'm picking something almost like randomly. You know what I mean? And I find that kind of like refreshing, like digging into a box, picking something. And I do sometimes continue with the series because I want to see how this pans out. The probability of me reading Birds of Prey number two now for a future episode, very high because I want to see what happens.
It's interesting to me too because I find it odd that I haven't read more Birds of Prey than I have. Because I like Barbara Gordon, I like Black Canary, I like female superheroes. So yeah, I just find it kind of weird that I haven't read more of it, and I didn't realize that. I thought that I knew it started out as a partnership between Barbara Gordon and Black Canary, but I didn't realize that Black Canary didn't know who Oracle was at first. That's interesting, because I think there was a miniseries before this ongoing started, wasn't there?
Yeah, I believe that's what, because
So they
it
tried it
even
out.
says on the cover, it's like before, because you demanded it, so this relationship has existed prior, you know. And Chuck Dixon is, I really like his work, like everything that he's done, I've pretty much enjoyed for DC.
Well, and he was.
Even on G.I. Joe, I've loved his stuff. I'm a fan of Chuck Dixon, so.
He done tons of Batman stuff back at that time.
Robin, I mean, it's done a lot of stuff. This is good stuff.
Nice. All right, well, kind of similar to what I just did. Another series that I picked up at around the same time, meaning, well, both when I started reading them and also when they're from, Legion of Superheroes, it similarly had a little bit of a title change around the same time that Green Lantern did. It went with issue 259, it went from being Superboy in the Legion of Superheroes to just for the first time, the Legion of Superheroes. And like Green Lantern, I've kind of covered it over couple different places, the same kind of flow, a couple podcasts, and then a Taylor Network column or two. This starts off a new story though, whereas the Green Lantern continued at this issue 262, catches up with a different group of Legionnaires. Writer Jerry Conway had kind of split the large cast up into a few different groups, and we'd been following one of those groups for the last couple issues. Well, this issue is called "The Planet That Captured the Legion," and the art is by Jim Sherman. Looks as though he did inks and pencils there
What was the issue
with
again, Chris?
262.
Okay.
Gene D'Angelo's the colors. So we briefly check in with a smaller group of Legionnaires that are working on rebuilding their headquarters, because even prior to in the storyline, prior to it becoming just Legion of Superheroes, their headquarters was destroyed apparently. So Light Lass, Ultra Boy, Wildfire, you've got Saturn Girl and Lightning Boy. I think that covers most of them. They're working on the headquarters, and Ultra Boy, he can use one power at a time. He's using his super strength to hold up a wall that's starting to buckle, and to continue to hold it up, he's got to use his super strength. He can switch to invulnerability so he doesn't get hurt, but then he's going to lose his super strength. Light Lass comes along and uses her powers to hold up the wall long enough that he can use his super speed to get out of the way, and then they let it drop. And there's a funny little bit where Ultra Boy's real thankful, so she says, "Light Lass, I could kiss you." She says, "Well, I don't think my man or your lady would be too upset by one friendly kiss." And so he gives her a kiss on the cheek, and he says, "Timberwolf must be one lucky fella. This isn't even serious, and I feel like I'm floating on air." And as it turns out, he's literally floating on air because she's using her powers to mess with him and levitate him. And it's just kind of like a purposely funny scene, as the Legionnaires have gone through a lot of crap recently, so they're happy that they can laugh again. And it's kind of funny because Lightning Lad or Lightning Boy and Saturn Girl, they're like two of the original three. They're talking about everything that's been going on recently, and they're giving a bit of a recap through their conversation of what's going on with all the other Legionnaires. And it's totally unnatural the way that Lightning Boy says it, because he specifically says every single person's name. So you can tell it's totally for the sake of the reader, because he lists every single Legionnaire that was off in that storyline that took place in the last couple of issues. And then he mentions everyone by name that's going to be in the rest of this issue. So after this brief bit in the beginning, we do have a different storyline with the Legionnaires that have gone off with RJ Brand, because one of the other things that's happened to the Legion is that RJ Brand has completely lost all of his money. There's this interesting scenario where one thing that Brand still has is this ship that has the power to create stars. And with this technology, he's actually making money by creating stars for planets. And he's got with him Cosmic Boy, Shrinking Violet, Dream Girl, Karate Kid, Colossal Boy, and Chameleon Boy. So when we check in with them, that's what they're doing. They're successfully creating a new star with this interesting technology. They're b firing this weapon, and it creates what would happen over millennia in this space of like a few moments. And I guess this is the first time that they've done it, because once they've done it, they all start hooping and hollering and celebrating, getting excited. So what ends up happening is they go to what is going to be their next location. They've received a request from a planetary system that's orbiting a dying star, and they're supposed to do their service there. But when they get there, the planet, the moon, all the artificial satellites have been blasted to pieces, and there's all this shrapnel and junk and dead bodies and stuff just floating around in space. But they do find one being in a spacesuit that seems to be still alive, and it's this very, so they take it back into the ship. It's this very alien-looking creature, insectoid kind of creature that they put on life support, and they're only able to keep it alive for a brief moment when Chameleon Boy changes his shape to look like one of the look like it's this, he's from the same race, and to try to find out what happened. And he gets information that he gets is that the alien says pirates from Galactic North heading south, due south, Galactic South. And they're like, what the fuck, like pirates, what is he talking about? But they follow the directions that they were told, and sure enough, they come across like old school pirate ships just floating in outer space. And they start firing on the Legionnaires' ships with real old school cannonballs. And then pirates with no life support or spaceships or anything like that, or spacesuits or anything, start floating out from the spaceships and coming after them with old school flintlock guns and cutlasses and things like that. So, like, I don't know what the hell's going on here, but we're not going to let them just attack our ship, even if they are doing it with primitive weaponry. So the Legionnaires fly out, and they start battling these pirates, using mostly, hand to hand, because they don't want to hurt them too bad. And Cosmic Boy's deflecting some of the cannonballs away from the ship. And then, so they're having this battle, and in the midst of it, they're not really paying attention, and one of the some of the pirate ships collide with the Legionnaire ship, and there's this huge explosion. So next thing they know, they wake up. They're all knocked out by the explosion, and the Legionnaires wake up, including RJ Brand, and they're all strapped to this big wheel. They've all been stripped down to their underwear, and all of a sudden the wheel lifts up in the air, and there's this voice that talks about decontamination for presentation to the engineer, and it gets starts spinning in the air super fast, and when they're let off, they're all super dizzy and everything, and they find their clothes, and there's all these there's this robot that comes up and says, "Enter, visitors, and meet he whom we were born to serve, he who gives our existence meaning, he constructed us and commanded us to protect and serve him through eternity, the engineer." And they walk up, and it's just this corpse lying in a throne. So this engineer that they're being presented to has been dead for a long, long time. So Chameleon Boy hacks into the computer, and the long and short of it is that this engineer, once upon a time,
And this time it died.
yeah.
Hello?
Hi.
That was weird.
I lost you.
Yeah, I lost you, and then it disconnected my recording and then restarted a new one. I've never seen that happen.
I guess I must have been talking for too long.
Your sentence was the engineer, and then you were talking about, and then I lost you, and then now you're back. Matter of fact, it redialed you. It disconnected and redialed you, I guess.
All right. Well, I was just kind of getting to this to sum things up. The engineer had died hundreds of years ago, and then this artificial planet has been flying through outer space, just operating on autopilot, basically, because the engineer created this place that was for his own entertainment. It was, and the pirates, all the that they had been battling, they were all androids, so that's how they were alive in outer space, because they're not. Weren't actually alive to the first place. So it's this fantasy world planet, so nothing's worked all this time. And again, it ends kind of abruptly. Like, the whole mystery, I guess, was just what was going on, because the resolution is pretty quick. Chameleon Boy, he just takes the form of the engineer and issues a command in the engineer's voice, and that shuts everything down. And then they just get back on their ship, and that's it. They just kind of take off. So it ends kind of quickly. It was a fun little mystery. I mean, it's kind of weird that there's been two stories so far since Superboy left the book, and both of them have kind of, in some way or another, because the other one was about this ship that was basically like an asteroid that was a circus that people visited, and there was a murder mystery on the asteroid. So it's like two different takes on a planet just designed purposely for entertainment. The other thing that this kind of reminded me of was that retro sci-fi movie Westworld, where there's like a planet that's all like automated.
Yul Brynner.
So it kind of reminded me of that a little bit indirectly, but
Cool.
it was pretty good. This is like this period of Legion. It was until it's like a tumultuous period where like the artist keeps changing and the writer keeps changing until they even acknowledge in one of the letters columns at one point that they had trouble getting a regular team on the book until you get to the what ends up being a famous run by Paul Levitz. So that this is like running up to this period. So
Very cool. I still need to complete my run on that too, but I'm just missing the ones that you went over. I have, but I'm missing the very first few, like where it cut over. Yeah, I almost have a full run of Legion. Just gotta
Nice.
work on it. And I found the Birds of Prey miniseries. It's called Birds of Prey Manhunt.
Oh,
That's
okay.
a 4-issue miniseries that led to this. And I don't own that either, so have to rectify that. My last one is John Sable, and I'll probably continue doing these John Sables every now and then because I absolutely love them. I'm a huge Mike Grell fan, and I love that he's writing this and drawing it. I like him as a creator. I have a lot of his I buy a lot of sketches at conventions, and I tend to go to the same people, and I think that's why I don't have too many bad experiences, I guess. 'Cause You could get sketches you don't like. You know what I mean? If you just go to somebody and you never got a sketch before, and you spend $100 to $200 on a sketch, and then you get something, and you're like, oh, I'm just not happy with that. But I tend to go to the same people: Andrew Peepoy, Mike Grill, Tom Scholey. And I'm always happy, and that I'll continue to do that. I'm gonna add Shannon Gallant now because I was really happy with my rice sketch, and Drew Moss is another one. So I'm just gonna continue going to the same people, getting characters that I like, because I'm happy with those artists, and I know them. You know what I mean? Robert Atkins is another one. The only thing, he's got such a list that it's hard to have him get caught up and then get your sketch. So as soon as Robert gets caught up, I want him to do an Exo Man of War for me. But
Nice.
having said that, I have like four pieces for Mike Grell. They're kind of all in the Warlord theme. But now I almost want to get, if he's at the Denver convention next year, I hope to get a John Sable commission
Nice.
because I really like it. But this is Mike Grell. It's first comics. Year is 1983, August. And they were doing Star Slayer at that time, E-Man, and Warp. I believe I have a full collection of E-Man, except I haven't read any of them. A Star Slayer, I only have the issues that involve the Rocketeer. But this interesting was this book was really interesting because I never knew the origin of John Sable. This gave me the origin, and it opens up with Mike, which is spelled MYKE. She's the artist for his children's book, and she's at the office of the publisher, and he goes as his alias as B.B. Phlegm, and he writes the Brothers Grimm. And she's like, he just took off again. I'm just his agent. I don't know where he went to. He probably went on another mission. And she says, well, you want to get to know him a little bit? Here, read this. And it's kind of like the origin of John Sable because they both know he's John Sable freelance. They know he has another identity. In the last issue, Mike went to his apartment and busted him and found out he was John Sable. Well, in this issue, it's a flashback, and she's basically reading the material. It's a very interesting background because he was an Olympian, and he met his woman, who he thought was German, but she was from Africa. She doesn't look like she's from Africa, but she's a blonde, and she's a gymnast, and she's
Maybe
been.
she's South African then.
She could be. She could be. It doesn't specifically say what part of Africa, I don't think. Well, maybe it does, but they actually live in Africa once they get together. But they hook up at the Olympics. She's abrasive at first. Oh, she's from Kenya. It
Oh,
do,
okay.
it does say where she's from. And he thought she was German, and then he says, "No, you're British." And she says, "African, Kenya, actually." And he goes, "That's two strikes. Want me to try for three?" And he's like, "I don't mean you just don't look like you're a gymnast." And she goes, "Tall for a gymnast? Strike three." So their relationship isn't going off well, but she performs, and you could tell she's a gymnast towards the end of her career. Like, she's trying to get a medal, but she's gotten medals in the last few Olympics. Do you know what I mean? And she's like kind of that Olympian that is trying to get the last medal, I guess, and then retire. He is in the pentathlon, and I never heard of a pentathlon. I've always heard of decathlon and other things, but it consists of equestrian. What do they call the sword? The fencing,
Fencing.
pistol shooting, swimming, and running. And he's a participant in that. And they both compete, but they don't get medals, and they kind of hit it off. And there's a huge terrorist attack on the Israeli team, and they kind of witness it, and they lose a lot of fellow Olympians in that. And as she flies back to Kenya as the Olympics are over, he actually flies back on the plane with her, and they eventually fall in love, and they decide to open up a safari called Sable Safaris Limited, and I guess people hire them to take them on safari, and they just have a baby, and their safari business isn't taking off very well, and it's a very awkward book to read if you're like a fan of animals and stuff, because he will kill animals and stuff, but he always has like a purpose behind it. Like he shows on his safari, there's one asshole that just he's like those Facebook ads where you see like some woman sitting next to a dead animal and smiling with the gun. Well, he's taking pictures of those dudes on his safari. Like they hire him to go on these safaris, and it looks like in this particular, he didn't like purposely try to kill this lion, but the lion went after him, and then this asshole has to get a picture with that. And then he sees like that poachers are in the area, and he doesn't like poachers, and it's killed an elephant for the ivory, and this asshole he's touring with wants a picture of him with his rifle in front of the elephant. So it's like it's a weird situation. And his job, I don't know if he likes doing what he's doing, but he knows he gets hired by a bunch of rich assholes. And he finds these poachers, and he actually starts fighting with them, and he actually kills a man that was attacking him, like trying to kill him. And he tells his wife what happened, and it was rough. And he's like, "This safari business isn't panning out." And so he decides to go work for another person where he can make money. And then he's got a weird job too, because he works for like this place that's like clearing out forestry, which means he has to clear out animals. So that's kind of weird too, you know? But you learn the backstory of his children's books, which are kind of interesting. They're a bunch of leprechauns, and he tells he you see the origins of how the book came to be. And one time he's out hunting. He's actually trying to clear the area, and he even says in this, "It's not fair. It's just the way things are." In other words, he goes near a herd. He said, "Herd culling has no relationship to sport hunting. It's a slaughterhouse operation, plain and simple. Increasing human encroachment on the wildlife habitat eventually leads to trouble for the animals." And then he says, "It's not fair. It's just the way things are. It's best if you don't think about it." And then he kills some of the wild buffalo. Do you know what I mean? So it's like, he's aware that this isn't right, but he says this is going to happen. I don't know. It's very disturbing. At least that part was for me. But as that's happening, and he's killing some wild buffalo, those people that he got into the altercation, the poachers, they attack his house, and they essentially kill his family. They kill Elsie and their kid, and they burn the house down. So that's his vengeance story. Like he lost his family over there, and then I guess the next story arc involves Africa. But very interesting book. I definitely want to explore it, see where it goes.
Yeah, I forget how far I read into it. I think I read up to that issue a while back, like more kind of around when we started the show. But yeah, it's definitely one of those hidden gems from the 80s,
Yeah.
you know, that when you had the indies really coming up in prominence back then. So
The poaching piece was a little hard to see. Like, I didn't even like him. The Olympics part was a cool backstory, but when he went back to Africa, choice of occupation I didn't care for.
Yeah.
Because he was conscious, he was like environmentally conscious of what he was doing, but he was doing it anyway.
Yeah.
So it was a little weird. And I don't mean to be a preacher of animals and stuff, but I think
No, I mean, you're just.
a lot of it's wrong, you know? Like killing an elephant for ivory and then thinking it's badass, taking the picture and then leaving it there.
Well, and you're
There,
just talking
there,
about
there's
how it
one,
affected
there's
you
one thing,
personally.
yeah, there's one thing to hunt, right? To eat, you know, to do stuff, and then there's another thing to abuse it. It's the abusive part of hunting I don't like.
Right.
I guess that's the part that bothers me. Personally, I'm not gonna. I hate those Facebook ads when people they show, look at this girl and she's 16 and she killed a lion or something like that. I don't like it.
Yeah.
A
Well,
lot of
I don't
endangered
think it's.
species and stuff. It just bothers me because I love animals in general. Like they bring me peace. Even the stupid squirrel that keeps eating the bird food.
Well, and when a situation like that, I think even some hunters aren't really a fan of that kind of thing, 'cause there's no real like sportsmanship to it.
Yeah.
Like those situations where like 16-year-old, like you're describing, lions in particular are not, they're not spooked by machinery.
Yeah.
Like so the vehicles and stuff like that, like you can drive right up to a lion in one of those and they won't run away.
Yeah.
So you can just get right up close and then just shoot them right from your vehicle. So there's actually no, like I'm not into hunting at all, but like I can see if you're into it when it's like there's actually some sportsmanship to it.
Yeah.
But I can't really like get behind that kind of thing where you're not even like
It's not even a
there's no
hunt.
challenge,
There's no
so why
challenge. Yeah, you're
yeah
just
so
shooting
why
to
you po
shoot.
yeah why are you posing, 'cause you really actually didn't accomplish anything.
Yeah.
But no, I mean, but it's an interesting topic.
I guess I'm a hypocrite though, because when it comes to spiders, I hate spiders. But I guess if I see a spider in my house, I want to kill it. And now
Yeah.
we have this bee infestation over here, which is we finally found the nest. They're not honeybees, they're hornets. But these things are aggressive, man. You go out there and you enter their area and they just get pissed.
Oh
So
yeah.
I want to go to war with those hornets, so hopefully we'll get rid of them this week. I finally found the nest. We were targeting areas that we never saw the nest, but we saw bees. And then yesterday me and Barb were looking up and it's like right near the roof. We have a two-story house. And I was like, "What is that thing?" And it's big. It's this huge
Yeah.
nest. And we're like, oh boy, I called the bee guy again. I said, we know where it is. You're gonna have to bring a ladder to get to it.
Nice.
But
Yeah, let them do that. That's crazy.
yeah. We always have had bees, not we've had bees in the past where you could see the hive, but the hive wasn't that big. This one's big. This one's it looks like I don't know, 8 inches or 6 to 8 inches in length. And it looks pretty deep. I can't tell from the angle I'm at. But and then it's another 5 inches long, so it's pretty big. That means a lot of bees.
Yeah, that sounds pretty serious. I don't personally have any problem with killing insects. I don't know. I don't think that that's hypocritical, but
It's interesting though, if you ever call pest control and if they identify you to have honeybees, they won't want to kill them because honeybees are rare and they provide something to the environment. They're like, we would rather you call a specialist to migrate the hive. Do you know what I mean?
I can
But
see that.
what if they're in your freaking wall?
Yeah, still got to get rid of them, but
Yeah.
migrating the hive sounds expensive. It sounds like anytime you got to involve a specialist, specialists are always more
Oh yeah.
All right, well, I'll finish things up. I'm actually going to continue my Daredevil reading that I've been talking about. I'm going to talk about two issues, but I'll go ahead and keep it a little briefer because of that. So last time we had, we had an Innocenti written issue, then we had one that wasn't last time, 236. That was, I think it was last time I talked about that then. So, but then we're back to Innocenti, and I think this is where she's really on the title for a while. I got 237 and 238. 237, like 235, was one of the first comics that I had, where I just kind of got them randomly. Oh, my bad. This is actually 237 is another one that's not Innocenti. It's 238 where she jumps back on. So this actually is John Harkness that wrote it. Pencils by Lewis Williams, inks by Williamson and Belandi, colors by Max Scheele. So this is called Context, and it has the Claw, as the villain, which is kind of interesting because when Mark Waid came back on Daredevil a few years ago, he started off with the Claw. But when the story begins, it's just Daredevil. He's fighting some hoods, just some street thugs, and he runs into Black Widow again, or Black Widow catches up with him again, and they do reference that this is, it's not Daredevil's surprise that he's seeing her so soon after everything that happened in the Hazard Affair, which is last issue, so it gives you the impression that a little bit of time has passed. And interesting, Black Widow actually wants him. She's got some politician. Well, she's the wife of a Florida senator. Wants him to wants some superheroes to stand up to steroids. The connected to like the drug testing programs in professional sports. They want some superheroes to also come out and say that they're not using steroids. And Matt Murdock is not into it. He's not. He doesn't want to do it. And at this time point, he's actually working as a short order cook in a diner because he's with all the events like the Frank Miller stuff. He's not a lawyer anymore at this point. So he's just working. He's just happy flipping hamburgers, and things don't go too well between him and Black Widow. She, in the heat of the moment, unintentionally insults him and insults Karen Page, and Daredevil has enough of it, takes off. And because he's living with Karen Page at this point, and Black Widow's kind of like, I think I was just a rebound for Karen in the first place when we were together, and it just gets a little awkward. The bulk of the story is a conflict with the Claw, and the Claw at this point is pretty much Daredevil knows him pretty much as a villain of the Black Panther. That's where he's heard of him, and Claw kind of wants to step up his game and be known as someone that can take out other superheroes, not just he wants to be known as not just a villain or not just an enemy of the Black Panther. So he's trying to up his reputation. He doesn't realize that at first that Daredevil's blind. Until later on, the battle goes on for quite a few pages, and they end up in a place where Daredevil shouldn't be able to see. And so Claw figures out that Daredevil's blind and is surprised. And ultimately, Daredevil takes him out by he goes to a place where he happens to know that there's a technology called a tone generator, and he because he's got the super hearing, he knows the frequency that the Claw is his sound weapon is operating at, so he adjusts it to that frequency of the Claw's vibration. and the vibration that takes them out. Those are a great issue. It's kind of neat reading these ones that I had back in the day, because I can some of the stuff I remember.
Right.
Like I'm like, oh, that looks familiar. The other issue, 238, is actually a tie into the Mutant Massacre storyline. That's a cool cover where Sabretooth is jumping at Daredevil, and Daredevil's protecting a woman behind him. This is by Anno Senti. The art is by Sal Buscema and Steve Laiola, with again colors by Max Scheele. And so in the Mutant Massacre, Morlock's being killed in the sewers, and so it's kind of created a power vacuum in the sewers, and these street thugs are down in the sewers trying to take over some of the territory, but Sabretooth is down there, and he wants nothing to do with it. He spooks a couple. There's like two guys and a girl, and he spooks two guys, so they take off, and he's like, "I want the woman." Sabretooth's like in a real animalistic state. Says, "I want the woman," and the guys don't put up much of a fight. And she's like, "Jake, Bob, don't leave me." And one of them says, as they're running away, says, "I don't die for nobody, sister." So these chickens, they just leave this woman with Sabretooth, and he just throws her down, says, "Shut up, your bed, our bed," and then goes stalking off, trying to find some food. But then he just goes to sleep, falls asleep next to her. So eventually, Daredevil's out, on patrol. He takes out a few guys, and interestingly, the guy that he saves, isn't happy to see him either. He's not. He's like, "You think you're waiting for your thanks, hero, for some applause? You're the one that tore up this town fighting with Super Soldier Nuke, and you two tore up the whole neighborhood and destroyed my store, and my life's gone." He's like, "I'd rather take my chances with the muggers than get saved by you." So it's a little bit of an interesting scenario there. But we're back to the sewers, and the street thugs are some more street thugs in another spot. Are trying to take some territory, and they're making a lot of noise and stuff, and they wake up Sabretooth, so he's pissed that they woke him up. He's about to attack the kids, and this little kid that's down there, he's like, "These are the streets that are protected by Daredevil. If you fight us, he'll find you and he'll beat you up." And that actually works out, because that intrigues Sabretooth. He's like, alpha animal kind of situation. It's like, oh, Daredevil's the badass around here. I guess I'm gonna have to go take him out. So Sabretooth literally sniffs him out, and much of the rest of the issue involves a fight throughout the streets between the two of them. Interestingly, it's interspersed with a cat chasing a mouse, and like scenes of a cat ch chasing a mouse inside of a house. Like as Sabretooth is jumping at Daredevil and knocking him down, we see a panel with the cat catching up to the mouse. Eventually,
Daredevil's the mouse.
Daredevil's a mouse. So eventually, the fight takes him back to through the sewers and to where Sabretooth was holing up. So Daredevil finds the woman that Sabretooth has tied up there, and Daredevil saves her, but not before their fight knocks down one of the nearby walls, and strangely there's a dead Morlock in the wall, and Sabretooth recognizes that Daredevil's using his sense of smell to figure out what's going on, because the way he tilts his head, and Sabretooth being Sabretooth, he recognizes him using that sense. So once again, it's this whole, "Holy shit, you're blind!" That and Sabretooth's actually impressed by that. So the last things wrap up with Sabretooth attacks the girl. Daredevil yells, "Protect your throat!" So she like moves her head in such a way that he doesn't get her throat. And then Daredevil punches him a few times to, and it slows Sabretooth down. And Daredevil is able to hear her heart, so he knows she's not dead yet, but she's pretty close. But he actually tells Sabretooth that she's dead. "What do you do with your kills?" And this sort of confuses Sabretooth. You know, he's like, "It's the hunger. The hunger. It makes me do things that I don't really know what I'm doing." And he's in this like weird animalistic state. So that actually kind of he gets upset and just t and takes off. And the last couple panels is just Daredevil talking to this woman, and she says, "You know, that's the strange thing. He didn't hurt me while he had me captive. It's like he wanted me, but he wasn't sure why. I was scared, but more than that, I felt sorry for him. He's a man trapped in an animal's body." So Daredevil wraps her wound, and it's like he was really gentle up until that last moment when he attacked me. And but then she kind of compliments Daredevil, and she said, "I thought that I didn't never realize that you were real. And sometimes when I was out at night, I'd look at the top of the buildings, pretending you were watching me. It feels so good to know you exist." As he's carrying her out, "I just wanted you to know that." Says thank you, and that's why I was. And then he thinks to himself, "That's why I was hunted, just because I exist."
Cool.
So it was kind of a cool issue. It's like she's kind of like it's mostly a superhero fight, but it's like Nocenti was kind of going to give it some like bit of a like a stronger metaphor to it or whatever. So it's pretty well written, but it's nice. I like Sal Buscema's nice art. But it's weird how this kind of. It's kind of like the Legion of Superheroes at the time that I'm reading it too. Like, it's this sort of transition was kind of a transition period. You know, Frank Miller had left the book, and they're trying to figure
You
out.
like to keep your themes.
I guess so. Yeah. Sometimes it's intentional. Sometimes it just happens. But yeah, they're pretty good. It's kind of I'm sort of enjoying the fact that I'm doing a little stretch of continuity there. Instead of just picking random stuff, which is what I do sometimes, that can be cool for its own reasons, you know.
Yeah. A lot of times I have themes too, but they're in not intentional.
Yeah.
They're just coincidental.
Sometimes we have connections between our like
Our
between mine and
choices,
yours,
yeah.
yeah.
We don't coordinate anything except for Buck Rogers.
Right.
I did get a retro book in the mail. I'll just mention real quick. I got a The Flash Omnibus,
Oh, cool.
Volume 1, which has, you know how we were reading the paperback. This is the
Right.
omnibus of it, except it, man, it contains a lot of stuff. It contains Showcase 4, 8, 13, and 14, and then Flash Comics 105 through 132, and a Golden Age Flash story from Flash Comics number 104. So it's got like a lot of comics in it. It
Yeah, I
can't, it
think
can't, came out really well because it's a lot bigger than, you know, what we had. In the
the
trade paper,
archives.
yeah, in the archive.
Or Chronicles, I mean.
Chronicles, yeah. So
Oh,
yeah,
that's cool.
I bought it. It's a really nice cover. It's expensive. Has a lot of the material we that are is already in Chronicles. So if you want that format, it's a lot cheaper.
Yeah. Although, like some of them, I don't know necessarily the Flash one, but they're not really keeping them in print. Like
Yeah.
some of the Batman and Superman ones have become harder to find.
They I don't see them solicited lately either. Like they it's almost like they abandoned that line, you know.
It's seeming more and more like that. For a while, they were putting them out like really infrequently, and then they solicited volume one of the Justice League Chronicles, and then they retracted it and just put out the Justice League
And
Omnibus,
that's what I
like
think
that
they're.
Flash
Yeah, I think
Omnibus.
that's what they're doing. And the other thing that I got that was retro in the mail is I got my first copy of Amazing World of DC Comics, which was a magazine-looking format where you subscribe to. And one of the amazing things about this series, the reason I got it is because it has unpublished comics in there. And this has an unpublished comic of Secret Society of Supervillains. So,
Nice.
it is a beautiful copy too. Oh my God. They're not that expensive, and I think I'm gonna pick them out as I get to them. The one thing about these magazines is this is number 11. So if you're a completist of Secret Society of Supervillains, you need to seek out. If you look at the covers for Amazing World of DC Comics, they are amazing. I mean, the covers are amazing. And it's a weird magazine. It has like solicitations that are coming out for the next 3 months. It has some articles like how to create your own comic books, and it's a very interesting magazine. I didn't know what to expect because it's my first one, but I was pretty impressed with the content of it. Like to dive into that at some point.
Yeah, it sounds cool. I'd be interested to hear about it some more.
Yeah.
So,
All right.
well, that's it for me.
That's it for me
That's all I
too.
got. Okay,
We're
we
almost
can
done
wrap
with
it up,
Buck
I guess.
Rogers, season one.
Yeah, I got
Four left.
3/4. I mean, I think the last
We might
two
combine
is
the
like a
last, yeah, we
two-parter.
might just combine them into one, but we're close.
I think I'm curious to continue on.
I am too. Yeah.
We could always take like an episode or two break and cover a movie or two or something.
Yeah, I wish we could get Logan's Run if you can get that.
Yeah, maybe we could do Logan's Run and like maybe I'll pick one out or something, and then we'll jump back into Buck Rogers, kind of like we
Sure.
took a break with Flash in the middle of the Fourth World.
Yeah.
But sounds good. All right. Well, this has been episode 42 of Geek Brunch Retro, and you can find us on Facebook. Just search for Geek Brunch Podcast. That's for both Geek Brunch shows. You can find us on Twitter. I am Mythmaking ETC. Mike is Mike Myers Brunch. Our emails are mike@comicbooknoise.com and mythmakingetc@gmail.com. And is there anything else?
Oh, I think you got it. Leave iTunes reviews, please.
Oh, that's what I was, yeah. iTunes reviews, yeah, leave a review. Thanks to those that have done so.
Thanks for the questions. Those are fun topics. Like, if we get more of those, you can send those at any time, and I'll just keep them for shows so we can cover them in the future or cover them on the current show, depending on when it arrives.
Yeah, that's a good point. Brian, thanks to Brian for the question and the conversation we're able to get out of that. And as you mentioned, I mean, he put that, even though it was too late for last week's show, we were able to get to it this time, and it worked out good because we didn't really have any other ones. So,
Right. All right. Well, you have a
yeah,
good
boy.
week
You
and
too.
enjoy your Sunday. Oh, what's left of it.
Yeah, I gotta do some cleaning.
I do too, but mine is cleaning. I'd rather clean comic books than clean, so.
I gotta clean up animal hair, basically. I
Well,
mean,
I do
it's
need to vacuum.
sweeping the house, but it's amazing. Like we have hardwoods mostly, but it's just like every week it's just like
Well,
I don't know how my
you have a
pets, we
long-haired
have two.
dog, though, too.
Yeah. We have two pets, so it's like between the two of them, it's like how are you guys not both bald with all of this hair I just swept up? Like I look at it in the trash after I dump it in there, and I'm like, how do you still have hair on you?
We've always had like pit bulls, and they're usually short-haired dogs, but you'd be surprised when they said they it's no joke, man. You have to stay on top of it.
I bet, yeah,
Yeah.
it's crazy. So. Well,
I
I'm
think
gonna
I'm
eat something
shedding
first,
too.
so yeah.
I'm letting my hair grow out, and usually when I do that, I start shedding.
Yeah, I always see my method of doing my hair in the morning is just to like dunk my head in some water and then comb it with my fingers. And I haven't owned a comb in I don't know how long. And so when I do that, I always look down and see some hairs in the sink.
All right, well, have a good one, Chris.
On that note,
On that
have
note, and now
a
with your
see
hairs in your sink.
with the hairs in the sink.
See you later,
All right.
Mockingbird.
Goodbye, Mockingbird 2.
Bye. Thing one and thing two.
Yeah.
Bye.
Adios.
Yeah.